Locked in at night. Yep.
She is. She's wonderful.
But we're on the road. Made it to Portland, Oregon. I mean, I got to be honest. I think that's so far one of my favorite stops.
Really?
Yeah. I liked Portland. I think it was because I really identified with the guys who were really just getting screwed.
Okay, so it's all right that Carol and I want to make a new Teamsters calendar? Think it's a great fundraiser for the effort? Those fellas, oh my, what? Longshoremen.
The ILWU?
Oh yeah, whatever. Fellas. The fellas. They were hot and muscular and, you know, I mean, support a Teamster. No, ILWU. Yeah, I'm sorry. I keep calling them Teamsters. They're the longshoremen. They're the Stevers. The Stevies.
Stevedores.
Oh, yeah. They were hot. Yeah.
Not nearly as hot as it was in Arizona and New Mexico. But, you know, as I look at the...
Yeah, they were.
As I look
smoking
at the...
Smoking hot.
Well, it's...
Yeah.
That is one person's opinion,
yep.
And I'm glad it's yours. But, you know, I look at the situation, and, you know, as you're going to find out throughout the program, as we have conversations with a number of the leadership and some of the members, we actually went out to two of the lockout lines where the workers are picketing. You know, one of the things that I want to clarify right from the front, because, you know, we hear a lot of people, when you see guys out on a picket line, oh, they're on strike because they're greedy or some other reason that's been thrown at. These guys, they want to go to work. They want to go to work right now.
Oh, yeah. They want to go to work so much that they're staffing that picket line 12 hours a day. I mean, they'd much rather be working. Much rather be working. It's ridiculous that they've been locked out of their jobs.
And this is an example of, you know, really international, global corporate greed. These are two foreign corporations who have refused a bargain, something that has been, you know, pretty much the norm for the area for, I think it was like 80 years, that these contracts have, you know, they've had their problems in the past. But this one, and as you'll find out as we move on through the discussions, this one a little bit different. This one's the companies, these foreign companies saying, you know what, time's right, the disaster has taken hold. Now it's time for disaster capitalism. It's for us. It's time for us to go and take back all of those hard-fought gains, all of those conditions that people fought for in the past, and, well, do away with it all in one felt swoop.
You know, that whole we don't negotiate with terrorists thing, I'm starting to think that's the attack we've got to take with these multinational corporations. You know, they are the terrorists of this world. I wrote an op-ed piece about the mountaintop removal. You talk about the Taliban. They blew up a couple of Buddhist statues and the whole of the UN went crazy. The mining companies in West Virginia are blowing mountains to kingdom come, and now these multinational corporations taking $500 million, $450 million in state and federal subsidies in Washington and in Oregon, and they're locking out the workers. They're locking out the taxpayers that paid the taxes for the subsidies they got?
It's the American way, Pat.
That's a slap across the face on top of everything else they're doing to them.
But, you know, as we talk to these folks, I just, you know, you look at these guys and you're big, strong, hulking,
yeah,
in the prime of their lives. And my daughter, as we were leaving, she goes, they're really sad.
Yeah, they are.
My daughter said, you know, the one guy, when he was talking to you, it looked like he was about ready to cry. And I go, well, you know what? He's got a family to feed.
Yeah. He's got obligations that he has the honorable nature to try and meet. In the meantime, these multinational corporations that are taking U.S. taxpayer dollars, they're not honorable. They're not honoring the fact that these people have worked for them. And you'll hear later on when we're talking to these guys, they went and testified in the state houses in Washington and Oregon asking for these multinational companies to get the subsidies.
Yep.
Talk about feeling like a fool. They went and said, this is our jobs. Make sure you give these guys the subsidies. And then they get locked out?
It's the American way, Pat.
That's disgusting.
It's how we do things in America.
Ugh.
It's kind of like, oh, I've been talking about. It's Stockholm Syndrome. You know, we identify with our captors, but these are the people who have said no.
These guys are not identifying. No, they are standing their ground.
Which is why they were kicked to the curb.
Right.
Which is why we need to support them.
How come standing your ground is okay in Florida, where you get to shoot a little black kid, but standing your ground isn't so good at a picket line?
Because I got my gun.
Sad stuff.
Well, anyway, tonight we're going to be talking to the folks with the ILWU, highlighting their history, highlighting their struggles, and we're going to talk about, you know, how can we help them? Going to take a quick break from the road, the People's Tour for America on the road. If you missed any portion of our coverage, therickssmithshow.com or People's Tour for America. Right back from the road. Stick around.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith. The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed.
Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. The People's Tour for America has rolled into Vancouver, Washington. We're here at the ILWU headquarters here in Vancouver, Washington, talking about, you know, the labor history tour, going across the country, talking to people. I've got Jim Norton here sitting with me. He's a pensioner, local 23 of the ILWU. Jim, thanks for taking time for us.
Excuse me?
Thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
You know, as we're moving across the country and as we're talking to people about the history of their unions, I thought it was important that the ILWU's history be told as well, because it's a rich history of activism and a rich history of people being involved. And, you know, I just wanted a little bit get your history on this. You know, you're a pensioner. Congratulations. You made it.
Thank you.
How'd you get started?
I was working as a young man. I was working on a log boom in Tacoma. And they went out of business, and a friend of mine asked me to just come down to Longshore Hall and see if you like it. And I knew a lot of fellows that were longshoremen, and that was in 1963. And at that time, I started working as a casual longshoreman, and I stayed till I retired. I worked up myself up through the ranks. I held many offices in the local, and I participated in a lot of union activities and all the time I was in the local.
Yeah, and what were the conditions like when you started?
When I started longshoring, let me say something first. Longshoring, they call us stevedores or longshoremen. A lot of people don't know where the term longshoreman came from.
Okay.
That term came in the 1800s. A ship would come into port, and they were usually schooners, very small ships, and they could dock at any kind of dock, a warehouse, or even come ashore, and they'd lay a gangplank down. But before they got there, the first mate or the captain would holler, "Work along the shore, along the shore." And he wanted people to come and help him unload the cargo. So from that derived the term longshoreman, and that's how we got, other than stevedore, that's how we got longshoreman.
Yeah, I always wondered that. Yeah,
yes. They'd holler, "Along the shore," and then guys would come and unload the vessel for them.
Interesting.
Or, you know, load it.
Yeah.
Both ways.
Either way.
Yeah, when I started longshoring, a lot of the work was hand work. Handling 100-pound sacks, 150-pound sacks. Everything was done mostly by hand. Mechanization hadn't taken over the waterfront yet.
What year was this?
This was 1963, and we didn't sign the mechanization agreement till 1966. That's when we gave up some of our work rules, concessions, to mechanize, but the employer had to guarantee us work. For mechanization, they guaranteed us jobs.
And that wouldn't happen today?
Probably not today, no.
So let me ask you, in looking at the conditions that you worked under in the 60s, you know, I'm sure they were much better than they were in the 30s.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Hey, what were the conditions like in the 1930s?
In the 1930s, I'll take San Francisco. That was the hub of the stevedore longshore activity on the West Coast. That's where probably when we had problems that usually originated in San Francisco because it was the largest port. But in those days, you would go on a ship and you would start the ship and you could work till the ship finished. In other words, you could work 10 hours, 12 hours, 14 hours. I actually talked to some of the old timers when I had gone to caucuses. That's a longshore division where we set demands for the contract.
Right.
And those fellows had worked 18 hours straight before they got a break. And when I started longshoring in 1963, we still had the 10-hour day and the 8-hour day, but it dropped from that time. It dropped from the 18 hours to 8 hours. But
that was because, you know, people fought for that, right?
That was because of the 34 strike. In 1934, we had a coastwise strike on the West Coast, and the main strike issues were a joint dispatch hall where we could dispatch men from that hall to the job, and the other one was called the shape-up. What the shape-up was you didn't go to the hall to get your job. You went down to the dockside alongside the ship, and a foreman would stand there, and he would pick the individuals out to go to work.
That he wanted.
Some of them would put a pencil behind their ear or a cigarette, and then he'd pick them out. But they usually gave him a fifth of whiskey, or they bought him lunch. There was some gratuity involved,
of course,
for them to get a job. So once we got the dispatch hall, then all that stopped. Then we had a joint dispatch hall where you went to work by earnings. In other words, if I went to work one day and you didn't have a job, the next day you'd go to work. So that's how then conditions kept getting better and better as time went by.
And that's important because, you know, you think back and you go, why do people go on strike? Why do people organize? And I always say it always comes down to conditions first, hours and then wages. And, you know, wages, hours, conditions. That's the reason people organize. And, you know, the more people we talk to on this tour, we find that, you know, the conditions, you know, of the past were horrible, got better, and now we're heading back towards horrible.
Yes. In 1934, up and down the West Coast, the conditions were horrific. I mean, there wasn't any one port where people weren't. We had people that were maimed, broken arms, broken fingers. I mean, it was terrible work. Work 10 to 18 hours on a shift. And now it's better. But the employer now has got an appetite again to go back to some of those same conditions.
The good old days.
The good old days for them, not for us.
Not for us.
You know. And so this is the problem we have. We're going to have to fight this.
And you go back and you look at the actions that went on, and it didn't come without a huge cost. And, you know, as we're going across the country and we're learning about the labor history, people literally died for the 8-hour day, literally died for safe working conditions, for decent wages, decent hours. We don't learn that in our schools anymore.
In 1934, we have a holiday in our union. It's called Bloody Thursday, July 5th. That's the day that two longshoremen were shot in the back in San Francisco. One fellow's name was Nick Bordes, and the other was Howard Sperry, and they left them laying on the sidewalk, and they were both shot in the back. And at that time, we were in tough in a strike, and we didn't know what we were going to do. But that, as horrific as it was, that united the people in San Francisco. They had a funeral for those fellows, and they marched down Market Street in San Francisco. 40,000 people marched in that parade, and as they went along the street, women and children would step into this march and march with the Union. And from that, when they shot those two guys, the public turned against them, and it broke the employer's back. And then we had a general strike. Our leader at that time was Harry Bridges. He was the head of the ILWU, and he was well respected by labor on the West Coast. And he went to all the other unions, and they had a general strike, and that broke the employer's back. That's when we got the joint dispatch hall, and the shape-up was done with. We went by earnings in the hall.
Yeah, but it was off the back of the blood of two.
That was off. Workers. That was not. That was not. Those weren't the only two guys that got killed, but that set the stage in San Francisco. Yes, there was violence up and down the coast. Terrible violence.
Now, in West Texas, a couple of months ago, a fertilizer plant exploded.
Yes.
And we were there last week or so. I don't remember the day anymore.
Yeah,
but there is a tribute to the seven fallen firefighters. There is nothing there. Nobody is saying, how do people die in the workplace? I mean, where if those two deaths and the ones that came before them could work to a critical mass so that people act, where's the action today?
Well, I'm not too sure I understand your question.
It's just that, you know, I'm waiting for this critical mass. If people can die in the workplace in 2013, I mean, and blow up a school and a senior home, and this fertilizer plant had no safety, no inspection since the 1980s, where's the outrage that leads to the kind of change?
Well, I think the problem is this country is being run by corporate America. And what you're talking about, say that would have happened in the 50s or the 40s, there would have been recognition by labor that they would have done something. But labor is in such a position now in this country that the corporate America controls labor that we really don't have the say that we should. We're going to have to fight. We're going to, you know.
But doesn't that come down to each one of us, to what we teach our children and so on?
It depends on education. Education is a big factor in what we do in the future, unions.
Which is why we're doing this tour, which is why I think it's so important that we talk about the strike in 34 and we talk about the history and how you made the work that you did for all of your years safe, how you made that work a livable wage, how you made that a middle-class existence. Because today what we're seeing is we're seeing the 1880s, 1890s all over again.
Yes, and I think one of the biggest problems that unions have in this country today is they're not unified. We have too many international unions that don't share in the problems we have. We're separated. We're divided. You know, unions, I hate to say this, but one union will go through another union's picket line. That's the worst thing we can do as union people. That's what's happening. Labor is fragmented in this country. We've got to unify labor.
Well, let me ask you, Jim, because, you know, and I've heard that before, and I go back and I think about my grandparents, who, you know, they lived through the Depression, they fought World War II, they came back with a mentality that, you know, we're all in this together. You know, do you think today you could get people do you think you could get the people today to get behind them?
Yes.
'Cause you do?
I really do. I have a lot of faith in a worker. And we have some bright, bright people in the union movement today. You know, they're well-educated, a lot more than we were in the past. And I think under the right conditions, labor can make a comeback. It's going to be hard, but I think it can be done.
Is it going to be, hopefully, not a situation where two more workers get killed or more? Because, you know, as we've been going across the country, we've been seeing these stories. You know, in Memphis, it took the two sanitation workers dying in the back of a garbage truck to spark community outrage. It took, you know, in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, it took, you know, 19 workers being shot in the back before you sparked the outrage. Is it going to be something like that?
No, I hope to God it's not going to be. I think with the membership we have in the unions today, they're well educated, they're smart. We have to take a different approach. I mean, the days of storming the precipice are gone. I mean, knocking down the buildings and, you know, and we don't want to get anyone hurt and we don't want to hurt anyone. I think we have intelligence enough in some of our unions to move forward, and that's what we got to do. The biggest thing is we've got to unify labor in this country.
I'm right there with you. I'm absolutely not just unionized labor, all
working
people.
I'm talking about all labor.
I mean, people have got to realize that we're all in this together, because if we're not, well, we're going to all get picked off one by one. So let me ask you the last line of questioning I've got for you, Jim. You know, in looking at back over your years, you're going down the road. You know, your work years are behind you, and hopefully you're having a wonderful retirement. You know, what about the guy coming behind you? What advice do you give them? What advice do you give their children?
What I see in the young union member today, when I go to the union hall, I go down there every once in a while. There's no more camaraderie. They aren't close like they used to be. We were very close. I mean, and I sit, and these the young people today don't understand how they got all everything that they have.
And how do we get them to realize that?
We've got to educate them. Educate, educate, educate. And that's what we have to do, and we aren't doing that. We're trying, but we aren't doing it enough. We have people now that they come off the street and they have a completely different feeling for the union than we did when we were young and went in the union. They're just a different type of young individual, and we've got to bring those people around. You know, we've got to instill a union in them, unionism in
community.
Them. Unity, too, and what it is to work together, you know, and have the strength of the union behind you.
Do you reach out to the media locally? I mean, Rick's show is so unique because he does this 3 hours a night, every single night of the day, of the week, every work night. Do you reach out to the local media, and do you get any coverage?
My feeling is we don't reach out to the local media enough. But to reach out to the local media, you have to be careful because you have to make sure that they're receptive to labor. And a lot of the media today aren't receptive to labor. In our local paper in Tacoma, we have to be careful because sometimes they print things that they construe things, they take them out of context. And that's one of the problems we have.
Well, that's the problem with corporate consulting
media. But we have to have the public behind us. We can't go without the public.
Yep.
We've got to have public support.
There's got to be a way to do it, though. They did it when William Randolph Hearst ran the papers, and he was the worst SOB that ever lived, practically, when it comes to media. So there's got to be a way, because really, this story, Rick Smith.
No, we're doing it.
And everybody that needs this story needs to hear this show.
Yep.
But I think, like, the program you have, is there has to be more of this. I think the union has to get involved in some of this stuff. I mean, more than they do. We've got to get to the public. The public now, you know, I mean, turn on the TV. You know, you listen to these big corporations, what they're doing all over the world. I mean, everything's international now. And we've got to take our place in this. You know, we've got to get in the fight.
I'm right there with you.
You know, so it's not going to be easy.
Never
is. It's just
is.
Like these grain negotiations. I mean, they're coming after us. You know, I've been around a little while, and I haven't seen it like this before. But, you know, we've had fights before, and we've come out of them pretty well. So I have a lot of faith in these young guys we have today. They're all smart, they're well-educated, and they'll take care of business.
I hope so. Jim Norton, I appreciate the time. It was really great talking with
okay.
you.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For sharing your experience. We're going to take a quick break from Vancouver, Washington, the People's Tour for America. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. You know, Pat, I listened to Jim there, and, you know, you think back to the conditions of the 20s and the 30s, and I think, you know, as we've been saying on this tour, I think we've really forgotten how bad things used to be.
I think we definitely have, you know, but I've spent an awful lot of my time traveling this country with the country's underclass, and things are that bad again. They're that bad for millions and millions of people. It's just that we've all been beaten down and told not to complain, and, you know, it's bad for me, but it could be worse. And, you know, we see the jar on the counter for a kid who needs a surgery, or you see the jar on the counter for the old man who can't afford a wheelchair, and people dig in their spare change and they throw it in the cup. Like that's the way a country's supposed to be run.
What?
You know?
We're not supposed to run our senior programs off a lottery and education off of, you know, off a lottery.
Well, you know what? I don't even mind that as much as I mind the fact that we're begging for it. We're begging for it, and it's supposed to be run off charity? No, it's not supposed to be run off charity. It's supposed to be run by an efficient government, well-funded, by taxing the people who have made it the best. The people who have, because of this country, because of the blessings of liberty and the protections of their strong military and the past history of however bad imperialism has brought them to this incredible wealth, they're supposed to pay back. How come the rest of us are supposed to pay back, but the extremely wealthy aren't? That's how we're supposed to pay for that stuff. But yeah. Even if it's done, even if it's taxation for people who can't do math, like in the case of a lottery, at least the government is sponsoring it.
You know, and you look at the statistics and the wealth concentration in the hands of the so few, and I think you pointed out, what was it, the top 10 of Fortune 500s, the top 10 CEOs,
the top 10 wealthiest people in the country make the same money as all the people who work in fast food. And the entire nation. Millions. I think it was about 3.5 million people have the same annual income as the top 10. Everybody in fast food.
I mean, it goes back to the days, you know, to where Jim Norton was talking about, you know, where you had the very, very, the robber barons and then the rest of us, you know, toiling in horrible conditions. And, you know, I've spoken to some of the fast food workers over the last several months. You know, this is not a great job.
And you know what? They're still nice to you. For 7 1/4 an hour, when I get a Big Mac, I ought to get my face slapped at the same time.
I'm sure someone just slapped you for the GP.
Just for the fun of it. Yeah, really.
Just for general principle.
as an act of charity. No, but I mean, seriously, people are kind. You know, when you walk into a place, into a power retailer to get some, and the guy who helps put your kid's bicycle together, you look at him, he smiles at you, and you know every one of his teeth hurts. You know, this is a kingdom's judged by its people. And our kingdom is rotten, because our kings are rotten. And they are kings. They're oligarchs. I was in a prison, kids prison in Coconino County, Arizona, a couple of months ago, interviewing the children that were there. And they had a government teacher who was trying to teach them the difference in governments, theocracies and democracies and socialism and communism. And there was oligarchy. And I said, son of a gun, you're teaching about oligarchy. And you know, oligarchy is when the wealthy and the powerful make all the rules just because they're wealthy. When the people with the money get to be the bosses. And it doesn't matter if they're fit. At least in a monarchy, somebody with some faith believes that God gave someone some power. This is just having power because you have money. And if you can steal that money from somebody else, then you get the power that goes with it.
The workers.
Right, you steal it from the workers.
And the thing is, you know, as we go through today's program and we talk to these guys from the ILWU, these are companies that are very profitable. They're doing just fine, thank you very much, but they want more. And that's my problem, it's that more. And I go back to the CEO of Caterpillar who said, you know, you can never make enough profit. And if that's the view, you can never make enough profit, what does that mean for the working people? What does that mean for folks like you and me, Pat?
There's never enough blood I can wring out of your blood, sweat, and tears. And it's offensive because they're not just screwing the longshoremen. They're screwing the farmers that are growing the grain that now can't leave the country because these people have decided to lock out the workers that would load the boats. So the farmers who need to sell their grain are... And maybe it's all Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland, and for those guys, I don't really care. But it's not. It's a farmers co-op. And there are farmers co-ops that can't get their grain to these other countries. And then there are the people in the other countries that are paying exorbitant prices for the grain. And the people who would be exporting the grain to them, they make more money because they've locked out these guys. It's a genius plan for the people who are shipping the grain, and it's bad for everybody else. Bad for the growers, bad for the consumers, and bad for the guys who have to load the boats.
And, you know, you go, well, short side, you know, it's going to cost the company money, but they know long term it's the control. It's we're not going to have an active workforce. We're not going to have a workforce who's going to demand better conditions. And, you know, one of the things that we'll find out later is the safety part of this that really blows my mind, that the companies wanted to do away with their safety.
But with $480 million in U.S. federal and state subsidies, it's not going to cost them a penny. They
Good
can
point.
Screw an American and make money doing it.
Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. You can follow the People's Tour for America, peoplestourforamerica.com. Find out where we've been, where we're going. Watch some videos, see some pictures, lots of opportunities to interact with the program. Also, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, all of that stuff. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you've got any thoughts, questions, comments, whatever. Whatever's on your mind. We're here in Vancouver, Washington. The tour has brought us into the Portland area. We're at the ILWU Hall here in Vancouver, and I'm sitting here with Cameron Williams. He's the president of Local 19, ILWU Local 19. Cam, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
You know, as president, you've got to have a long history of being a union member and well, part of your family, no?
No, I actually... Through some of my friendships early on in my life, I got in the industry through friends that I knew that their fathers and grandfathers were longshoremen in the Port of Seattle.
Kind of took you under their wing.
Yes, exactly.
So how did that, having not known, what did you know anything about unions before you joined? What was your thought? What were your impressions before you started?
Absolutely. Unions, through prior knowledge, unions set the standard for American workers, conditions, safety conditions within industries, and obviously they're a key component to setting standards for families in America,
and for the community as a whole, and my personal history as well. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and that idea of getting a union job, that was the ticket to the middle class in my view.
Yes, yes. But.
You didn't think that you could find an easier line of work than being a longshoreman?
I enjoyed the work. I started working when I was 18 years old on the waterfront and have never left. 17 years later, I continue to work on the waterfront and try to give back as much as I can to the union in capacity of representing the members of the union.
Let's talk about what's going on the waterfront, because as I understand right now, there's a lockout going on.
Yes, sir.
Tell me how'd this happen?
We've been in a tough set of bargaining. It was apparent from when we sat down with the employers almost a year ago now that they wanted to change the dynamic of the grain industry on the West Coast, as well as the Puget Sound and Columbia River. And we knew that we were in for a tough set of bargaining when we sat down at the table.
And who are these companies?
There's three elevators that are operated by Temco Cargill, which are U.S. owned. You have two by a Dutch company. Out of the Netherlands, Louis Dreyfus. There's one Louis Dreyfus facility in the Port of Seattle where I represent members. And then there also is a Louis Dreyfus facility in the Port of Portland. You have United Grain here in Vancouver, Washington, which is owned by Mitsui, which is a Japanese group. Then you have Columbia Grain in Portland, Oregon, which is owned by Marubeni, which is also a Japanese group. Currently, we're locked out at the Columbia and United facilities, the Japanese-owned, foreign-owned companies. Louis Dreyfus has not officially locked us out at this point. They've chosen not to operate their businesses or their elevators and are sitting idle during this period of a lull in the grain export business. Typically, this time of year, it's kind of ramps off a little bit.
Right.
So you're loading grain to go to other countries?
Yes, export. 50% of the exports out of the U.S. are exported out of the Columbia River and Puget Sound.
Wow. As I'm listening to this, I'm thinking about, a Dutch company, two Japanese companies, countries with strong union backgrounds, where workers in those countries have much stronger protections and much stronger ability to join and form and collectively bargain and all that. And yet those companies have chosen here to lock the workers out.
Yeah. Just for the record, though, as I stated, Louis Dreyfus hasn't officially locked us out at this point. It's the Japanese foreign-owned companies that have locked us out. And then obviously with the dynamics of negotiations, we have an interim agreement with the U.S.-based company, Cargill Temco, which operates in Tacoma, Port of Tacoma, Port of Longview, and as well as the Port of Portland.
So you're talking about an industry-wide contract. Conditions across the industry are set, correct?
Right, right. It's what they call the Northwest Grain Agreement, which is structured for the elevators that I identified in the Columbia River and Puget Sound.
And why is that good for the region? Why is that good for the community?
It brings stability, I think, within the community. Currently, you know, as we're locked out, it's had an immersive effect on our members, primarily in Local 4 and Local 8. Upwards of 100 to 200 jobs are affected where our members aren't in there working as we've traditionally done for almost 80 years.
Wow. Now, this agreement, this industry-based agreement, how many people are we talking about? How many workers are we talking about?
Roughly 3,000. It covers the Port of Seattle, the Port of Tacoma, Port of Longview, Port of Vancouver, as well as the Port of Portland.
Now, how long is this agreement? How many years in the past have we been talking about this agreement? How long has it been in effect?
This is a mature agreement. Upwards of 80 years this agreement's been in effect.
So now we're talking about radical change.
Yes, yes. As we went into negotiations, we received a proposal package from the employers of over 756 changes.
You know, and I think about this, and you look at the community that's affected by this. What kind of reaction are you getting from the people in the community?
Well, I think, you know, we're getting positive reaction. Obviously, foreign-owned companies receiving federal and state subsidies to build these facilities, as well as tax breaks that they're receiving. And then it's kind of ironic that they're attacking the American worker and the ILWU.
So they're getting state and federal money. We're taxpayers. We're giving them money, put in their pocket, and they still want more.
Yes. And initially, we're giving them money to attack us in the workplace.
Now, what about the farmers who make the grain? They've got to be angry that their grain can't be exported. And what about the people where the grain would go to? Prices must be going up. I mean, this isn't just nailing you guys. It's nailing a whole pile of other people.
Well, I'm not an economic expert, obviously. But, yeah, it's a complete supply chain that's affected by these companies essentially taking on the ILWU and taking on American workers, you know, good family wage paying jobs, the members of Local 4, Local 8, ILWU members as a whole. We contribute immensely to the economics of those communities, and that's been affected. So it's affecting the community as well.
Let's talk about your members, Cam, because, you know, at the end of this, they're the ones being most affected by being locked out, these are dedicated long-term employees who, in my view, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, have just been thrown to the curb.
Yes, yeah, so maintaining picket lines here in Vancouver, been on the picket line since February 27th, upwards of 5 months now. Port of Portland, 3 months, I believe, at this point. So, our members are being greatly affected. The Port of Vancouver and the Port of Portland, the ILWU locals in those two ports depend heavily on the grain export and working in those facilities.
So let's say, now you this goes on a couple more months. It's my view, whenever these lockouts happen, the idea is to break the union entirely and get rid of it, and then bring some people back in at much lower wages and much worse conditions, and all of that comes with it. How much of it, in your view, is trying to break the union and get you out, or just to get better concessions out of you?
Well, I believe that was the employer's intent from the get-go. Obviously, they've employed Gettier Services, which is a strike-breaking firm out of the East Coast. The ILWU has dealt with Gettier and Boron in the struggle with the miners in Boron. And it was apparent from the get-go that they were, orchestrating this move to try to take the union out to an extent.
Now, this is what the United States does in other countries. So I think we can look for really profitable nations to go to other countries to try and hurt the workers there. Now, luckily for the United States, they can try and hurt the workers here, too. But, I mean, I don't think we should be that surprised that the Dutch and the Japanese, who have such a wonderful workplace for their own workers, are going to other countries where they can exploit the worker.
Well, fortunately, the Dutch haven't locked them out yet.
Yeah.
But, you make an interesting point, and, I look at the Japanese
By shutting them down, does that mean you don't have work?
Yes, exactly. We went from 186 vessels in 2011 in the port of Seattle to it'll be from 2012 to 2013, roughly six. So a significant decrease in vessels coming into the port of Seattle. You know, whether that's based on the overall commodity market as a whole.
So where are they going? I mean, are they going to other ports? I mean, have they diverted work to other areas? Is this?
Or there's a belief that the grain is being being diverted out of the Northwest, the Columbia River, as well as the Puget Sound region.
And do we have any idea where?
It could be going through Canada. It could be going through the Gulf ports. You know, as I stated, it's speculation at this
right.
point. But there's good reason to believe that is the case.
So how long? You know, having been on strike myself in the past, and this is not a strike, this is a lockout. This is where the companies have said, this is what you're getting. If you don't like it, we're going to throw you to the curb, and I understand that. But having been in a situation where you're walking a picket line, you know, it's a struggle keeping members cohesive. What are you guys doing to keep people together? What are you guys doing to keep the fight going?
Obviously, it's imperative during these times that we stay together and that we fight the battle together. You know, we're calling on global support. You know, the ILWU has reached out to reached out overseas to our fellow dock workers, and we're all together in this fight, and we ask for support globally as well as locally.
Because if they can break you, they're next.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think everyone has to understand that. And the reason I think these stories are important is because today it's the longshoremen. Today it's the people working on the docks. Tomorrow it's going to be people working in a warehouse. The day after it's going to be workers across the country who are going to see this. This is not something only you guys are fighting. This is something that virtually every worker in this country eventually will fight.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you last line of questioning. You know, as we move forward in this, you know, how do we help? How do we as consumers? How do our listeners? How do people help in this?
Community support, global support is key to winning this fight. We got to talk about the tax subsidies that these foreign-owned companies are receiving. We got to address that problem.
Do we know what kind of numbers you're talking about when you're talking about tax subsidies?
You know, I don't have exact numbers. That's probably information that we can get you.
Because, you know, I saw something the other day that said Mitsui, is that how you say it, Mitsui?
Mitsui, yes.
They got something like $275 million. What was that? The West Vancouver Freight Access Rail Project.
Don't you think that I don't have a lot of faith in Congress anymore, but when that stuff was said, okay, let's give this money to these people, that was so people in the United States would have a job? That was the purpose? You know, I mean, really?
Yeah, it's a great point.
Yeah, which is why we've got to get involved. And I say we contact our representatives early, often, and tell them to put a stop to this. This is sad stuff.
Now, you're keeping your members alive. Can people send money?
At this time, I believe that we're not currently set up for any monetary gifts, but we appreciate the support. You know, obviously getting out to the rallies, getting out and talking to the state legislators, talking to officials back in Washington, D.C., you know, bringing to light the struggle that the ILWU is in and labor as a whole is in currently in this country.
Sad stuff. Cameron, we appreciate the time. Thanks for telling us what's going on.
Thank you very much.
Cam Williams, president of Local 19 of the ILWU. Quick break right back from Vancouver, Washington. Stick around. The People's Tour for America continues right back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. You know, Pat, in talking with Cam Williams, you know, you look at this story here in Vancouver and the Northwest, and it's not unlike a lot that we've seen in other industries. You know, I think back to the Caterpillar thing. I think, you know, some other things that we've talked about over the years where the employer goes, you know what? We've got the upper hand. Take what we're going to give you or we're going to kick you to the curb. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you go, how'd you get to that point? And, you know, what negotiation, what were the offers? You know, how'd you get here?
That's been the story of every broadcasting job I've ever had. You want your job? You got 50 people who want your job instead of you. You'll take what we give you.
Yeah.
And
or to the curb with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you'll never get another raise. You'll never get another benefit.
Which is why we've got Rich Austin here. He's the co-chair of the Northwest Grain Negotiating Committee, also a member of Local 19 of the ILW year. Rich, you know, I listened to Cam tell the story of, you know, guys getting kicked to the curb. Yeah, how did it get to this point? You know, in this environment, I can't imagine that you asked for just for any really anything other than maintaining what you'd already fought for.
Yeah, that's right. The union went into this negotiating with a list of 17 demands, pretty reasonable demands, very modest wage demand, some work rule changes, but pretty modest stuff. The employers on the other side came in with, I think, the intention of completely eviscerating the Northwest Grain Agreement, you know, one that we've had for 80 years, and they proposed 750 changes.
750 changes?
There was over 750 proposed changes.
How long was this agreement? I mean, were there 750 lines they could change? That sounds like it must have been the whole thing.
It was darn near the whole thing. It was basically a replacement contract is what we viewed it as.
So how long have these two companies owned these companies? How long have these two foreign companies owned the companies that we're talking about?
You know, I'm not certain as to the length.
I mean,
of
is
that,
this something new? They just took over and now, hey, we're gonna rewrite everything as we can. Have they been in, you know, has it been 5, 10 years?
No, I don't think it was a case of that. I think it was a case of
opportunism,
the harvest being what it was, and some other things that are out there. I think these employers took the opportunity to take us on.
So you look, well, and the conditions. I mean, you look at the economy the way it is, and unemployment as high as it is. You know, we're seeing that opportunism everywhere. It's not just you. And the thing that I keep telling our listeners is that, you know, if these workers didn't have a union, if your members weren't members of ILWU, those 750 changes, those would be imposed. It would just happen. And there would be no recourse. There would be no standing up and saying, hey, I don't think so.
That's right. I mean, it's what keeps us from becoming a third world country is labor unions. That's that only buffer.
I mean, we're close. I mean, we're moving towards Bangladesh every day. You know, the more we talk to people on this tour, the more we talk about their conditions and the hours that they work and how screwed up their hours are, what kind of family life you can have, the more I realize, quickly, we better start taking to the streets.
You know, Howard Zinn, who wrote The People's History of America, said the only way for the United States to become a true imperialist nation is to have a third world at home. You cannot put resources at home if you intend to invest all your resources overseas. And so this is basically what's coming to pass.
That's right. I mean, you know, capitalism, you can't satisfy its appetite. So you mentioned about the imposed conditions placed on some workers, and then there'd be another group of workers that would replace them because those people would finally get tired of those imposed conditions.
The race to the bottom never ends.
That's right. There's never enough. So when you ask an employer, what is it going to take, they never give you a response because they don't know the answer.
Yeah, and I think back to the quote that we used a couple months ago from the CEO of Caterpillar, who said that there's never enough profit. We can never make enough profit. Which, you know, you just sit and you think about that one statement. You know, then how little will we pay our workers? Will we ever give them benefits? Will it ever be enough where they get a raise or decent conditions? No.
Right. And conversely, the union comes in there with very specific demands. You know, like we mentioned, or I mentioned, the modest wage increase, you know, some work rule changes, more time with our families. We're very specific when we're asked what is it going to take to get an agreement. And we're very realistic and reasonable.
You mentioned work rule changes. And I remember the 2012 election, Romney running around the country saying, oh, these unions, oh, they want all these onerous work rules. And you go, well, I don't know. I've seen a lot of companies that I've worked for where the work rules actually saved the company from themselves. Saved themselves from disaster. One of the companies I worked for, they had the mechanic going out and throwing the oil in the field behind the facility. The union said, whoa, can't do that. They actually saved themselves from themselves. And how many of these, you know, when you talk about work rule changes, you know, any of that you could possibly say that we were saving the company from themselves? By having safer work conditions so people don't get injured on the job and you don't have people out on workers' comp and, you know, all the things that come along with that. Because I'm of the view that, you know, when you sit down and you negotiate, hey, we want to make this company better because I think the workers want the company to succeed, because if one succeeds, so do they.
That's right. You know, the best stewards of the job are us as the workers, right? And we pointed to some what we felt some flaws in the current work rules and would help the employers in regards to safety and productivity, you know.
Now, I, granted, I'm from the East Coast, but I, for a living, for the last 25 or 30 years, I have read the news. That's my job. Literally, nobody's talking about this. Nobody's talking about this lockout. The media is not covering it. It's not a topic that makes it to the front page of the New York Times that I've seen. Why isn't anybody talking about this? This is a federally subsidized, state subsidized, foreign companies basically nailing the U.S. worker. Why is that not something that's shown up? I mean, I could see if I wasn't a news junkie, if I was just somebody trying to feed their family and work every day, but I'm not. I'm like glued to the internet. Why don't I know about it? How come it's such a silent reality?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question. And to respond, I think it's because in those publications that you mentioned, you can find out where the sales are on Xbox at Walmart and some of these other places. I mean, this is what we're being fed. We're not being fed real news, real issues, you know. And so, unfortunately, it seems like our country has
infotainment.
Yeah, migrated towards that, you know, rather than real issues.
Well, do you think it's that they've migrated toward it, or it's what we've been force fed?
It could be a combination of both.
Well, I do just know that an awful lot of these businesses I'm talking about are owned by the corporations that want to crush you. So them talking about this news story would be counterintuitive to their own success. If they're going to crush the labor movement, they're not going to do it by having their corporately owned newspapers and TV stations tell stories about you. So how do you get the word out if the corporate media is also locking you out?
Well, it's tedious and it's cumbersome, but it's worthwhile. You know, we have to engage ourselves in grassroots programs. We have to get out. We have to talk to each other. You know, put down our iPhones for a little bit and knock on a neighbor's door. We have to contact Absolutely. Our congressman and tell him, no, this is not okay. You know, sometimes when I'm at my kids' ball games, I engage in conversations with other parents. They ask what you do for a living. I say that. You know, sometimes, wow, that's a great job, strong union. Sometimes you see their eyes roll. And I'll engage that person even further, you know, and ultimately get to the point where I'll make the statement that, you know, if you look to all the developed countries throughout the world, what are the common denominators? And I say they're fair and democratic elections and labor unions.
Yep.
And we're lacking in this country, unfortunately. I'm proud to be an American, but the U.S. and our union density, we're going down. I mean, we've seen some controversy in our elections in the last decade, and so if we're okay with that, if we're okay with being last, then let's continue down the course we're on. But if we're not, let's right the ship. You know, let's get a hold of our congressmen and say what's happening to workers in general, what's happening to the ILWU at these grain facilities is not okay. It's not okay that a foreign-owned company can operate a facility in the United States and lock out its workers.
I'm with you. But the answer is not just going to the congressman. It's actually putting us in those positions. You're not going to the Millionaires Club and saying, oh, please, can we have a little bit of something? It's actually infiltrating that Millionaires Club and getting people like you in those seats, people who actually know what it's like to get their hands dirty and work for a living and not pretend that they're clearing brush for a photo op, but actually knows what it's like to have to do that day in and day out every day of their lives.
Do you know there's one member of the United States Congress that does not have a bachelor's degree or higher, and he is a labor union member? Mike Michaud from Maine. Yep. Was a paper worker. And he ran for office because he was sick and tired of the way people were being treated. And now I think he's in his seventh or eighth term.
That's fantastic. You know, we encourage our members to, of course, run for port commission. That's to our best interest. We encourage them to run for school board, be involved in their communities.
Yeah.
You know, and we have.
We need more, absolutely more of that. Let's bring this back for a minute, Rich, because, you know, in looking at this situation, these negotiations, when you sat down as a member of the negotiation committee, you know, were these different from past years? Did you see any, did you know from the beginning that this is where this was heading? Because, you know, we've seen a lot of this stuff go on. And, you know, every person that I've talked to who's been involved in the negotiations said, you know, we knew before we sat down this is where this was heading. Because what they came out with was just so egregious and that there was nowhere else for us to go. So they threw out this last best and final offer, which was just ridiculous. Because they wanted us to strike, or they wanted us to go out. Was this the scenario?
Absolutely. I think all of us knew that this would be different. You know, there's a requirement under the NLRB that you correspond with each other of the intent to open. And the correspondence that we got from the employers was I can't remember exactly how it was phrased, but it spoke to the termination of the Northwest Grain Agreement. And that was a little bit new. And so we were all a little bit concerned, and that was part of our, you know, discussions of how we formulate a demand package and things like that. You know, let's be realistic. We went into the first day of bargaining, and like I had mentioned prior, they set down their packet of 750 proposed changes, and we just knew that it was on.
How much do you think that is what's going on with the National Labor Relations Board, with this attack from Washington on the board and trying to neuter it, and which they've actually neutered it?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with it. I think they knew that the laws as they're written, or the laws that they're the way they're being applied, favor the employers. I think they knew they could get away with something like that. They had no intention
it's the perfect storm.
Yeah,
the perfect storm.
Faith. Exactly.
You know, the economy's still in the tank. The NLRB's been neutered. You really can't get a decision out of there. And now you've got the contract come up.
I just want to throw out that Wall Street's up 25%. The economy's not in the tank for everybody. Yeah,
Wall Street's fat and happy. The CEO suites, they're fat and happy. Corporate profits have never been better. All of the wealth indicators through the roof. Wages as a percentage of GDP, never lower. I mean, stop and think about that for a minute. Mm-hmm. Profits never higher as a percentage of GDP, and wages never lower.
I think for the average American to understand that the stock market's actually up 25%, and the economy has recovered, but they're not seeing it. If you want to know why you're getting skim milk, it's because someone's taking all the cream.
Well, I think Emmanuel says. I think the two studies that they've done, 2010, of all the new income since the recession in 2010, 93% of it went to the top 1%. In 2011, 121% of all new income went to the top 1%. So what's that telling you? That's telling you that the wages that you guys were hoping to maintain, you're actually falling backward. And the top 1% is stealing that as well. They're not just taking the cream. They're taking the cow and the grass and everything else.
You know, if I could, I think it's important to note, so throughout these negotiations, I guess, for lack of a better term, because negotiations would indicate or imply that there's some back and forth, but that wasn't the case, is that those 17 union demands were completely dropped, and at some point we started working off the employer's document. We went places that we never thought we would go, and I think it's important for your listeners that may have a different opinions of unions than maybe we share, know that, you know, what they've learned about unions maybe on Fox News or some other places, in newspapers and things like that. We went places we never thought we'd go with flexibilities and hours and extensions and things
and
like that.
And just more.
To get a contract. That was our main goal, was to get a contract.
And their insatiable appetite for more, it was never enough.
That's right.
It breaks my heart. Stephen King wrote a book one time about a man who was marooned on a desert island, and he was starving to death, so he started cutting off his own body parts and eating them. Not exactly breakfast fare if you're out there having your Cheerios right now. But that's what corporate leaders want us to do. They want us to start eating ourselves rather than actually have a fair shake, and it's horrifying.
Yeah, and it's got to stop, which is why I'm I am glad to see that there are people who are willing to take to the streets. And we've brought up Patriot Cole, and on July 9th, we'll be in Fairmont, West Virginia for the big rally they're going to have there to say, hey, stop stealing our pensions, which is why we came here to Vancouver, Washington, because we want to talk about these issues, because I think it's vitally important that every worker realize that there are things going on. There are people who are fighting back, and that when things are imposed on you in the workplace, there's a recourse.
Is there, we ask this of pretty much everybody, but especially in this case right now, because you guys are ground zero right now for the labor movement, what can people do to help you?
What people can do to help us? Well, like I had mentioned before, you know, write their congressman, encourage them to intervene, to get involved in this.
You know what we're going to do? I'm going to talk to Mary, and we're going to get something up on the Facebook, on our website, the PeopleStoreForAmerica.com website, and we're going to get something up that people can just fill in the fields, and it'll go to their congressman. So it'll be as easy as possible. You go to the PeopleStoreForAmerica.com today, fill in those fields, and we will make sure that your congressman hears that you want to, ILWU working their butts off over in Vancouver and Portland, get there in Seattle. Is Seattle down too?
No, we're currently not locked out. The elevator is down for lack of business is what we've been told.
Rich Austin, we appreciate the time. We appreciate your insight into this. And again, you know, nothing but the best for you and your members.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break here from Vancouver, Washington, the People's Tour for America. And if you want to follow us, peoplestourforamerica.com, you can find out where we've been, where we're going, who we've talked to, people like Rich. Quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
And employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. The People's Tour for America on the road. And if you've missed any of our coverage of the tour, peoplestourforamerica.com is where you can find all the places we've been, Pat, and we've been to quite a few.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go home and get out a map of the United States and retrace our steps I was thinking about Memphis today. My gosh, that seems like it was forever ago, and certainly a whole different climate ago. We've lived through 4 or 5 different climates. We've had rain now, which I thought we'd never see again. It's just been really remarkable. And thank goodness for Portland, Oregon, and Vancouver, Washington, for giving us a little bit of rain after all those deserts we were in.
And tonight on the program, we're focusing on what we came across while we were in the Vancouver, Washington, Portland, Oregon area, as we talked to the members of the ILWU, the International Longshoremen and Warehouse Workers Union, out there in the area. They're being locked out by two big multinational corporations who've said, you know, our profit's more important than your living, our killing over your living.
They've had a contract for 80 years, and they came in, asked for a few things, asked for a pay raise, asked for a couple of things. The company came back with 750 things they want to change, which was effectively the entire agreement they've had for the last 80 years. So the labor union came back. They said, okay, fine, you know what? We know times are tough. We'll just stay with last year's contract. And companies, these multinational companies, they are not United States companies. These multinational companies, one of them's from Holland, and, you know, they treat the people in Holland much better than they want to treat the U.S. worker. And I love the Dutch, but this isn't about people. This is a corporation with a bottom line, and they want to grind these American workers. They came back and they said, now, guess what? You don't agree to all 750 of our changes. You're locked out. You don't come to work anymore.
Well, it wasn't the company from Holland. They haven't agreed yet. It's the two Japanese companies that locked them out. The one from Holland, maybe, we don't know.
So they might do it.
They might.
But they're not.
Still in negotiation.
Okay, well, I've got my fingers crossed that they behave themselves. But, you know, the Japanese are wonderful people, too. It's these corporations. It's not about people.
And the other part of it, it's about how weak our labor laws are. I mean, that's the reality.
Yeah.
You go to these other countries, and the laws are much different. And you know, Rich brought up the NLRB, which the right wing in this country has demonized and vilified. You know, the group that's supposed to kind of keep the peace so that workers continue to work, employers continue to make a profit, but, you know, there'd be a playing field. And what I loved is, you know, Rich brought up the Boeing situation, which is something that just drives me insane whenever I hear the right wing talk about, well, the NLRB, they have too much power. Really, too much power? If I was the head of the NLRB, I wouldn't have allowed that plant to be built in South Carolina for the reason that, well, Boeing said, we're going to leave Washington for the sole reason of breaking this union and getting away from the union. And that's why they're going to South Carolina.
And the governor of South Carolina said, come down here, we'll help you bust the union.
That is a violation of the law.
And the National Labor Relations Board should know it.
Well, no, they did. And they ruled, and well, then there was this huge, huge outcry from the right wing. When Leif Solomon, the administrative law judge, said, hey, this is a violation, the right wing went nuts. And then there was an agreement between the machinist union and Boeing to keep most of the work in Washington and, of course, you know, give in on the South Carolina plant. But, you know, the politics of this whole thing and the power of the wealth class in this country was never more apparent to me than in that whole Boeing situation.
Well, they own Congress. I guess they can tell them what to do.
And it wasn't, you know, just them. It was all of them. It was the media. It was everybody who jumped on.
Well, they own the media, too.
Well, there you go.
I mean, I say this over and over again, but there ought to be 1,000 Rick Smiths, or this show ought to be on all over this country in absolutely every market, because there are not enough voices that are telling the truth about this stuff.
And you know, the thing that bothers me is you look at the attacks on the NLRB of just trying to say, hey, you know what, there should be some law and some rules in the workplace, and there should be someone who enforces those rules and laws. The right wing loved the NLRB during the Bush years. Loved them because, well, they got to make the rules that they wanted and interpret it the way they wanted, which is, you know, no worker has the right to organize. Because if you remember the Kentucky River cases where they said, well, you're going to be a supervisor if you have 10 minutes of oversight of another person, so you have no right to unionize. They had no problem using the law to harm workers. But boy, when it was starting to level out, well, now we got a serious problem.
You know, I don't understand these people anyway, because they're the ones who buy homeowners policies and extra riders so that if their jewelry gets stolen, they're compensated for it. They don't want their stuff stolen. They don't want their houses broken into. They want an effective police force. They hire private security. They're the ones who want rules enforced. They want safety and security.
Just not in the workplace.
Just not for anybody else.
We want the dictatorial control of the workplace. It's sad stuff. We're going to take a quick break from the road. The People's Tour for America on the road, going across country. If you want to find out where we've been, where we're going, peoplestourforamerica.com. Right back after this.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the love and cup. till the river rose up. I saw the bride in a wedding gown. I was in the house, in the house.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you've missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website, therickssmithshow.com, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, as we made the trip from San Jose up the I-5, what an amazing, beautiful, picturesque ride it was up to the Portland, Vancouver, Washington area. Just an amazing ride yesterday.
The Cascade Mountains. Oh, my goodness. So beautiful. And, you know, and having been in West Virginia, where they're almost flattened, West Virginia, it's the new song.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that. I was thinking, if these national parks weren't here, I bet these mountains would be... The next one's on the chopping block.
There you go.
Yeah. Amazing.
It's just amazing ride all the way up here. And it's just beautiful country here in the Northwest. Just amazing stuff. But here again, you know, we go back to the reason of this tour, and it's to talk about the history of workers, the history of labor. And I've got Scott Mason. He's the president of ILWU Local 23, and we are in the ILWU's Union Hall here in Vancouver, Washington. Scott, thanks for sitting down and taking time with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You know, before we get into it, because we've been talking about what's going on with the grain millers and what's going on the ports here right now, I want to talk a little bit about your personal history, because you're a fourth-generation longshoreman.
That's correct. My great-grandfather was from Scotland, and he was a Seattle longshoreman. And my great-uncle was kind of my path to the waterfront through the Tacoma waterfront, 26 miles south of Seattle.
So we're talking a long, rich history just through your family line.
That's correct. And my personal story is I started on the waterfront when I was 16 in 1969. We could work in the grain elevators, as sweeping the elevators, and we could work in the warehouses. We couldn't go aboard the ships till we were 18, but our first shifts were in the warehouses and the grain elevators sweeping. So.
No, you go back and you look at this stuff. You know, these are fairly dangerous jobs at some point, right?
Oh, that's.
I mean, working in the grain elevator and
yes,
it's dangerous stuff.
When I started on the waterfront, the accidents and the injuries, very few longshoremen, if they ever made it to my age, I'm 60, they all were in pretty bad physical condition. They all had fingers missing. They'd been beat up pretty bad. Nowadays,
how
dangerous.
How'd you make it better?
How do we make it better?
Yeah, I mean...
We have a document called the Pacific Coast Maritime Safety Code that's a phenomenal document that has increased our safety year after year for the last 80 years, so...
And that's something that they're trying to destroy.
The grain elevators would have liked to have eliminated it completely, and they did in some cases where we're locked out, but not where we have an agreement with TEMCO. We actually protected that.
Before we get to the TEMCO agreement, I'm just fascinated by your story.
Okay, a little more of my history is in 1969, if you ever remember, the Vietnam War is going on.
Right.
I'm a 16-year-old kid working on the waterfront. In 1971, the longshoremen went on strike for over 100 days, 150-some days, I believe.
Wow.
And I ended up leaving to go work for Foss Tug and Barge as a union job, and I ended up going to college 2 years there, then I went back on the waterfront as a casual longshoreman until I graduated from college. The importance of that is, in those days, longshoremen wanted you to go to school, get an education, leave the waterfront, the dangerous waterfront that didn't have much of a pension, didn't have much of a medical plan then. They wanted you to better yourself and leave the waterfront, not knowing that they would build such a phenomenal place that it was a whole lot better to come back to being a longshoreman as opposed to working for a CPA firm.
So. What's interesting about that is, you know, I used to do some organizing, and I remember people who would tell me that, well, we're only here for a short time. We're only going to do this job for a couple months, maybe a year or two. And I always said, you know, well, if you're only going to be here a short time, why not make it better for the next person who comes along so it's better for them and that you've gone on to better things. God bless you. Good for you. But it's better for what's behind you. And what you're saying here is exactly my point. You know, they said, go on, go get education, go get a better job. But in the process, still made that job a pretty damn good job.
Oh, they made improvements that made it far better job than putting a suit on every day that I did when I was an accountant. So, yeah, I was glad to be back on the waterfront, and I ran for office to give back to my union. So,
and good for you. So let's move to this contract. TEMCO is the one company that has come around to an agreement, correct?
We have an agreement with TEMCO and three elevators. That's correct.
of the 750, did they ask for any of the 750 give backs that the other ones did?
Originally they did. They were part of the association, and as far as we're concerned, they're still a group. Okay, they started as a group. They've always negotiated as a group. And at the end of the day, they are a group of organized grain elevators. This particular elevator company, Cargill, in our case, Temco. Temco is a partnership between Cenex, which is a farmer's co-op,
okay,
and Harvest States, which is the Cargill subsidiary that they do their exporting with. So, but the money of the operation is Cargill, which is located in Missouri.
And this is a huge corporation.
Huge, huge corporation.
Behemoth.
It's the, and I'm not sure there's much significance to it, but it seems to be the company that has the most current American roots in comparison to the other companies.
The other ones, right.
Could that be why they're the only ones who've actually signed anything?
I'm not sure. It seems like they were, you know, we've had this 80-year agreement, and it seems like they recognize that they've been profitable working with the unions, with the ILWU, and that they were still profitable, and that my impression was is that they, you know, you're trying to sense things, and it seemed to me that they wanted an agreement.
And part of it's a farmers co-op, so that's a bunch of guys that are also collectively bargaining. They're a co-op of farmers, so maybe they understand.
You would think so, but I really think, unfortunately, the farmers co-op guys, they don't really recognize that they may be co-opted. I mean, yeah. co-opted by foreign governments and foreign companies that are trying to control the supply of their food supplies in foreign countries moving on into the future.
So I'm interested how that happened. I mean, because you're saying, because, you know, having been a truck driver for years, I was a member of the National Master Freight Agreement, and the companies had TMI, Trucking Management, and it's kind of the same dynamic. You had the companies on one hand, and you had the workers on the other. How did you get one company to split aside from the group and come around to an agreement? Or was it just a difference in negotiating right from the beginning?
No, it wasn't negotiated right from the beginning. I believe that was a decision they made on their side, amongst themselves, that they did not want to go down the same road as their...
Because it's costly.
Well, it's costly. I don't think they... Just my personal opinion, I don't think they felt it was necessary to create a war.
Right.
At a time when there was a lot of grain to move in this country.
You know, I think back to this, and I go, you know, how costly must this be for the companies that, you know, that have locked you guys up? You know, because they're not getting the grain moved. It's not being done as efficiently. There's not as much productivity. And there's strife and all of this stuff going on. I can't imagine that they view this as something that they're going to profit from.
Well, I think they're looking a little further down the road, that once they have torn us down at the scorched earth, once they get us completely gone, then they can build what they want. So I believe that's kind of their motivation. Cargill... It might be notable that Cargill is also involved in labor negotiations for energy, for salt, for the salt marches in Oakland that you probably saw down there in that area. That, as I understand it, the negotiator that we have at our table has been in this business and negotiated across from those before me for the last 30 years, and he's also responsible for negotiating with, I believe he said, 40 other contracts, labor contracts with unions. So he knows how to do it, and he knows it can be done without eliminating the unions like some of the others want to just totally eliminate the unions. I believe Cargill's found that they can make a profit and still work with the unions. So that's...
I have nothing to prove that by. No, I'm with you. But, you know, my view is, you know, when you sit down and you actually have a conversation... And you negotiate, you both do better, I think. There's a frame out there, though, that if I guess this is where a lot of my listeners may think that, you know, well, maybe the company should get rid of the unions because they ask for too much. They ask for too many wages, and it's not profitable. I don't view it as that. I mean, when you sit down, you make a negotiation, you come up with a contract, it's so that you both do well, right?
Yeah, it's so you both mutually benefit. They don't have to worry about each individual guy's problems personally, they can work with the organization for the improvement of everybody. Productivity measures, for instance. Grievance procedures benefit both sides.
Right.
And employers will tell you they lose control when you have unions. Truth of the matter is, if they use the contract, that there's a method for them to manage through the contract without obliterating the contract to their benefit as well as ours.
Yeah, I know a guy who runs a small business, and he's got like several employees, and he said, look, the best thing I ever did was signing a union contract. And you go, whoa, what are you talking about? The best thing he ever did, he said, I did away with all of my human resource problems. I need a worker. I call the union. They send me somebody. Everything's written down. And this is the wages. This is the hours. This is conditions. This is all of this stuff. And you go back to this is what you're expected to do. It's all right there. And it makes perfect sense to me as an employer to say, you know, you'd want those things as well because everything's in black and white.
I think the world of the worker in the United States of America right now is so bleak. We've got people running for president of the United States saying eliminate the minimum wage. This isn't like a fringe person who's, can't catch traction. This is a person who is winning states saying we should eliminate the minimum wage. I think the worker is really literally under assault in this country. And so there doesn't seem to be an effective pushback that's, you want no minimum wage. You don't have to experiment in the United States. You can go to Haiti. You can see what happens.
Bangladesh.
Yeah, but even they had a minimum wage. They had $31 a week. I mean, we're talking about no minimum wage. You think $31 a week is bad? Wait till it's rich. You know, I mean, this is really what people are pushing for in this country, and the pushback seems to be missing.
From where we live geographically, high intensity, I don't think is near high enough intensity of union jobs. But we also come from the area where Boeing airplanes are built, largest exporter in the nation. And South Carolina seems to be their mantra. If you have a governor in South Carolina, as far as I'm concerned, that makes comments that are completely illegal when she says Boeing's going to build their airplanes and they will never be union, and she says that and nobody
says a word about it.
Nobody says a word about it. Now, as far as I'm concerned, she just broke the law.
Well, I mean, the whole and the argument.
They like that in South Carolina. They also like it when their governor goes to the Appalachian
Trail.
Yeah, and actually is in Argentina with their girlfriend.
That's correct. So we're seeing a lot of that. My hope is that we organize the airplane manufacturing workers in South Carolina just like they do.
And they're working
in
on it.
Seattle.
And they're working on it. But let's go back to this TEMCO agreement because I'm fascinated by how. One of the three groups have came around. What's in this agreement? I mean, I'm curious.
Let's not be unrealistic about this. This is not a perfect agreement. Of course, no agreement's ever perfect.
Nothing
ever is. Any time that the union thinks they got the best and got everything they were going to get that was on the table,
they got shafted.
They're wrong. And any time the employer thinks that they got everything that they could have possibly extracted from us, they're wrong too. So if both sides are a little bit happy and a little bit displeased, you probably got a good agreement. Okay, in this agreement, they got some things that they really need, that they thought they really needed to be competitive with other grain elevators in our area and nationally. Okay, we recognized that, and we knew that those were going to be obstacles we could not overcome. But what we got out of the agreement with TEMCO is we still have a grievance procedure. When you still have a grievance procedure, you still have your dignity.
Right.
As a worker. You know, if we had lost our ability to grieve, you might as well just give up the rest. Because if you don't have the ability to grieve when they harm you, you're in deep trouble. The other thing we were able to salvage that there's not in the last best and final agreement that was rejected by the rest of us, or by everybody, was recognition of our safety practices.
So doing away with that, what you said at the beginning?
They would. Our safety book is as important as our wages, is working safely. And we were able to protect those rights in this agreement with TEMCO. In the last, best, and final, no safety agreement.
So what are the chances of using this agreement?
Whoa. They wanted to negotiate with you guys and say, we're taking away safety.
Yeah.
They didn't want to negotiate.
They wanted to eliminate it and have no mention of it in the contract.
But this is stuff people don't hear. I mean, this is stuff that needs to be said, I think, over and over again. This place wasn't saying, look, we're going to save money by cutting your wages. They say we're going to save money by running the risk that one of you guys loses an arm. This is what we want. You want
someone
a head injury. We want a head injury. I mean, this is the stuff that needs to be said over and over again. This is how you stop them from saying, and we had some great people saying, it's not greed to want to be able to feed your family, right? But we're not even talking wages. We're talking they want to say, if the plant blows up in West Texas, so sad, too bad.
My impression, yes. Another important aspect of this TEMPCO agreement is there was some positions called master consul, this guy that runs the board and does the things, and they wanted to convert those to management jobs, saying they were redundant. My impression has always been if there's a redundancy, get rid of the management guy.
Absolutely.
Okay? In the TEMPCO agreement, we were able to protect those as union positions, and they recognized it that we can do those jobs as well as management. In fact, we can do it better.
Absolutely.
Okay? So we were able to protect those in the agreement with TEMPCO that we are not able, that in the last best and final was not an option.
So how did your members vote on that?
Our members voted around 80%, as I recall, in favor.
How'd you get them to agree to make a better last best? It's not so last anymore. We're going to agree to what you want.
Oh, it didn't take much selling. As soon as they knew our grievance procedure and our safety parts were gone,
but how'd you get management to agree?
How did we get management to agree? I think that they just recognized that there was not a loss to them to have a grievance procedure and a safety contract. It wasn't a big deal to them financially. We gained one more thing out of this agreement that it's critical to. We brought one more grain elevator under our master agreement, or what we envisioned to be a master agreement, or an acceptable master agreement.
Right.
That was working outside of this agreement. And that makes it difficult anytime you have all these different
sure.
standards out there, right? So TEMPCO, along with us giving some things, we got something, too. We were able to bring another elevator under our contract, a third elevator.
That's important.
And that was – they didn't own this elevator prior to the last negotiations. So when they bought this third elevator, the old Kalama, that made it three. So we did get a benefit out of – we gained another elevator from – TEMPCO in this agreement.
Last
so TEMPCO didn't have to worry about two different contracts either, working two different contracts within their one company.
Last question I've got for you, Scott. You know, since you've brought that up, how many grain elevators are in this region? How many of them are under this agreement or under the agreement if you get the other ones back? How much of the industry would be under this agreement if you could get the locked-out workers back to work?
All but two.
All but two.
And we would eventually strive, of course, to get the other two.
Because once you have them all, I mean, once you have an industry-wide standard, you now set the competition at who's the most productive, who has the best product, instead of who's willing to work for less and under worse conditions. And that's the goal, correct?
And they're all moving the nation's grain, right? And they buy and sell it between themselves. So if we can get everybody playing on the same ballpark in the same field, level it for everybody. We see it as a benefit to us. Probably a benefit to the farmer, too.
It's a benefit all the way around.
Right.
Scott, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you. Really a great story. Fourth generation.
Thank you.
Scott Mason, local president of Local 23 of the ILWU. Quick break back here in Vancouver, Washington, for the People's Tour for America. You can follow us, peoplestourforamerica.com. Quick break, right back.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show. Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show. I give my hand to you.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you've missed any of our tour, the People's Tour for America, go to the website, thepeoplestourforamerica.com. You can find out where we've been, where we're going. Any thoughts, questions, comments, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, Pat, in talking with Scott, you know, a fourth-generation union member, fourth-generation worker there, you know, you think back of how these things get passed down generation to generation. And, you know, as we've been finding out on this tour, as we've been saying, you know, for the last generation, there's been a bit of break, which is something I think we need to fix.
I think that's why you invited me and everybody else out on this trip, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, the whole idea of letting people know that the truth isn't that the roads to all this beauty and the majesty of this country, like, fell out of the sky. That, you know, the Carnegies did a little rain dance, and next thing you know, we had interstate highway systems. You know, that this whole place is settled by workers. This whole place is developed by workers. This entirely wonderful, beautiful country of ours is the fruit of the labor of an awful lot of people, and even more of those people had a horrible life doing it. And when they fought for themselves, when they stuck up for themselves, they did it thinking this horrible life I have won't be the life of my children and my grandchildren. And then, lo and behold, greed takes hold.
And you know what's interesting? You know, one of the things he had talked about was this idea and this concept of industry-wide contracts. And I've talked about the National Master Freight Agreement in the past, which was for truck drivers, that industry-wide agreement to where, you know, this is the floor, this is the bottom, this is the condition for all the entire industry. And these are the rules under which the industry, if government isn't going to do it, we the people, we the workers, we will. And for a couple of generations from 1964 forward, the National Master Freight Agreement was that agreement that raised up the standard of living for truck drivers. And I remember my grandfather telling me when he first started, he was shoveling coal off the back of a coal truck for like 17 cents an hour.
Wow.
Homeless, you know, there was nowhere for, he came back from the war, nowhere to go. And because of the industry-wide, that growth towards an industry-wide standard, you know, he led a fairly strong middle-class lifestyle. My grandmother, as she said, they never wanted for anything, really. To me, we need to be talking about growing those industry-wide contracts again so that you're competing on the right things, on productivity, on quality, on innovation, and not on, hey, am I willing to slit my neighbor's throat for a penny?
You know, I think your grandmother, we should just all use the, what was your grandmother's name, first name?
Charlotte.
We need the Charlotte test, okay? Because Charlotte said she never wanted for anything, but you know why? Because Charlotte was reasonable in her wants. Charlotte never wanted for anything. You know what? Mitt Romney and Romney have never had what they wanted.
Which
they've
is
never
everything.
Had enough.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so it's got to pass the Charlotte test now. That's my rule. If you can be content with a safe place to live, a warm place to live, security, happiness, not giddy every day, but the kind of happiness that comes from knowing that your grandson's healthy and he's doing well and nobody's beating him up every day in school. Well, that was kind of because you were beating everybody else up, right? But that, you know, that all these things really matter and that you've got the things that matter and that you don't really need anything else. But no, I mean, she didn't need a Bentley. If she needed a Bentley, she wouldn't have been happy because she wasn't going to get a Bentley.
That's an interesting point and an excellent one at that. You know, I think, you know, and I've had these conversations with people who are fairly well off, and they think that, well, you just want everyone to be equal. And I've never said I want to live in a mansion. I never said I want a massive house or any of that opulence. I just want to be able to make sure my kids have food on the table, make sure there's a roof over their head, an opportunity to have some security in old age. I want to make a living, not a killing.
You remind me of a really sweet woman that used to live at the shelter. And I don't know if you've ever been to Safe Harbor, but it's a four-story old hotel. And it's got big grand staircases and giant huge windows. And a couple of the rooms have literally floor-to-the-ceiling windows that we had to close up somewhat. Big old beautiful hotel. And this woman was just a little bit, you know, she was not, she had a developmental delay. And I can't imagine what it's like to be a parent and know that you're going to die and leave your handicapped child to fend for herself and she'll end up in a homeless shelter. But anyway, this woman came up to me one day and she said, you know, I always wanted to live in a big, big house, big, beautiful staircases and great big windows like this. But I didn't want all these homeless people in it.
Wow.
You know, and I ran to my office and wrote it down because it was adorable and it was cute and it was funny. But it was also the truth. You know, that's what we've got now. We've got great big huge buildings full of homeless people. Because we can't say that, well, you don't need a Bentley. You do want everybody else to have at least something.
Yep. Going to take a quick break from the road. The People's Tour for America going across country. Check us out, peoplestourforamerica.com. Right back after this. Stick around.
Rick Smith. Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. The People's Tour for America on the road. We've rolled into Vancouver, Washington. This is a beautiful area, Pat.
Absolutely wonderful. And I was so grateful for the rain.
You made it up to Crater Lake.
Yeah.
1,800 feet deep. I was going, I'd love to scuba dive that, but 1,800 feet, you just can't get down there.
You need one of those crazy suits with the big metal hat thing and the lead shoes. And
always wanted to do that.
Go down to one of those old
things?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you what, Crater Lake was so beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm traveling the country with Rick Smith and his family, writing the history of the labor movements we intersect with, because this will no way be a comprehensive book on labor history. But, and I'm thinking, things I never thought driving through a national park before. How'd this road get here? Who built this road? What kind of wages did they get paid? When was this done?
I'm changing you.
All of a sudden, you know, instead of, besides the absolutely beautiful trees and the fabulous, and then the snow, the 6 feet of snow we were in and everything else, I'm thinking, I want to know where this road came from. And so I'm going to have to do all this research when I get home to put those pieces into place.
Well, you've got your work cut out, and we do as well. I mean, when we go back to the studio once this is over, there's so much to go back and revisit. Mm. But the reason we came out here,
I hope we're revisiting a great success from
here in Vancouver. Right. I hope so as well. But like I said, we're at the ILWU headquarters here in Vancouver, Washington, and I'm sitting here with George O'Neill. He is the chief dispatcher over at ILWU Local 40. George, what does a chief dispatcher do?
Well, the employer will place their orders for the men they need for the different jobs, and the dispatcher dispatches the men to the different jobs.
And how do you do that? Do you do it in seniority order, or do you, like a guy earlier, you know, Jim Norton told me earlier that, you know, guys would line up and they'd have pencils behind their ears and cigarettes behind their ears and a little, maybe a fifth of whiskey on the side?
No, not at all.
You get any of that?
No, absolutely not. Every local, first of all, does it a little bit different. But primarily the same. In my own local, when you're done with a job, you call and check in with the dispatcher, and we will tumble people up and wherever you come out in the order. When you're first out, if I have 20 jobs, I will offer you all 20 jobs, and you get to pick what you want.
Nice. It's kind of like when I was working freight. You'd come for the shape at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you know, in seniority order, you go, okay, what run do you want? And there's, you get on the list until everyone got work for the day.
Kind of like the NBA. You know, you got good players and you got good jobs and you pick the good ones first and, no?
That's a stretch.
But all the players for us were all equal.
That's a nice change.
And do you guys have seniority lists, or is this a...
What your seniority does is it can get you a promotion within the local.
Oh, okay.
But as far as the way the jobs are hired, they're all equal. Because everybody gets an equal chance.
It's one of my biggest complaints about the shapes. It went in seniority order. So the guy at the bottom sometimes didn't get any work. And I always thought it would have been better to have a kind of like a rotating thing to where everybody at least got a little bit of something. How do you guys, I guess the question is, how do you make sure everyone gets a little day's work here again?
Well, that's, you know, like I say, other locals do it different. And they do have, I know other locals have rotating boards. So everybody, nobody can get two jobs before another guy gets one job.
Good.
You know?
Well, that's interesting. So it's interesting to know. But we've been talking about the situation that's going on here, and I know you're keenly aware of what's going on with this, with the lockout. So what I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, what kind of support are you getting from the community, from the international community, locally? What kind of support are you seeing from folks?
Well, locally, we've had some ministers from different churches come out and actually, when we're doing rallies, be with us and speak and have written very nice articles on it. We have a lot of politicians that actually have sent us letters here that you can have if you'd like. You know, the senators from the state of Washington and from the state of Oregon, the governors, have written letters to the company saying get back to the table and try to work things out. The public, you know, you get a mixed bag.
Right. You know, it's interesting you brought up the ministers because, you know, we were in Memphis, Tennessee, where Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. And the thing that I think most people don't realize is the reason he was in Memphis was to support the sanitation workers. Who were on strike at the time. And it's always been my view that religion, you know, as I grew up in the Catholic Church, you know, it was social justice and economic justice and peace, instead of kind of some of the strange things we've seen recently. But there's a marriage there between labor and the faith community, because there is a sense of fairness and a sense of equality.
Yeah, I agree. Totally. You know, I grew up in the Catholic Church also. And, you know, and I don't really want to go on religion. I'd rather, you know, I really don't.
But, you know, if you buy the tenets of Christianity and of all religions, there's the sense in that you take care of the least among us and you make sure that there's equality and opportunity for folks.
Make sure you tell the Republicans that, will you please?
I was just going to say, wait a minute. I think you drank some Kool-Aid somewhere along this trip, because, you know what, there are an awful lot of evangelical...
I know, the prosperity
that
gospel
are,
people.
That are telling people that labor unions are bad. And, you know, there's only one unity, and that's the unity in God and all that other stuff. And that is the problem, is people are hearing from the pulpit political speak and anti-fellow man speak that is really devastating to a lot of what's going on for unionizing people, even without a union.
Which is why I thought it was important to highlight the fact that you've got people in the faith community who are advocating for you.
We do.
Yeah. So let's talk internationally, you know, because this is an international situation as well, I think, because
Absolutely.
You're talking about exporting to the world. What kind of support are you getting internationally?
Well, you know, and you're right. It is, because, you know, a lot of us, we all work for the same employers. It doesn't matter what country you're in. And what, you know, where I want to start out with, on the wall over there, it says an injury to one is an injury to all. And that is our creed, and that is truly what we believe. You know, I just recently went to Hong Kong, where they went on strike. The dock workers went on strike, which was a monumental move for a country like that. I mean, they would work their workers sometimes 24, 48 hours a day.
Wow.
I mean, you know, continually.
How can you be productive and how can you be safe? And I guess it doesn't matter.
You can't. I mean, the crane drivers that would go up in the crane, you know, if you had to use the restroom, you took a bag up there with you. Seriously. That's what they told us. They have them all split out, you know, like even on the one dock, they had like six different unions working there. And they had like, but none of them hardly ever worked for the main guy that owned it, Hutchinson, because he didn't want to be responsible for them. They subcontracted out with different unions and they all had different contracts. He's trying to split them. But we went over there. We got there the same day that they actually went back to work. And it meant a lot to them that here we're from the United States coming there to support them. And then the following day, we happened to go to Mitsui and Marubeni. We went to their offices in Hong Kong. Our international vice president handed them some documents.
And Mitsui is important to this conversation because they're one of the people who has locked out the workers.
Both of them are, Mitsui and Marubeni. Mitsui here in Vancouver, Marubeni in Portland. And we couldn't get into Mitsui, I believe. But Marubeni, we got inside their office. They didn't know who we were, and then we were in their office. And this one lady would not accept our documentation. You guys said, our vice president, Ray Familetti, said, throw it away. We don't care. We just want to give it to you. Just saying, you know, hey, go back to the table. She would not. They finally called the police, and the police were pretty good. We just said, hey, we want them to take it, and we'll leave. And then finally we just left. It wasn't a problem, but, you know, we just wanted to let those, you know, let Mitsui and Marubeni know we're all over the world, and we have support all over the world from different unions.
And the key to this, and, you know, I've been calling for international unions to do more organizing in places like Bangladesh, because if we allow them to exist, and in Haiti, if we allow them to be exploited and used, it comes back to us. And, you know, during the whole Bangladesh thing, we had talked about for the long, you know, when you deregulate and you have an environment that allows that to fester, when does it come back here?
It already has, free trade agreements.
Yeah, and in the new one, the latest one coming up, the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
right,
free trade agreement, is probably going to be the end of them. That'll be the end of free trade agreements, or the end of us talking about them, because there's that add-on portion to the TPP that should be interesting. So people just add on to that one. We'll never have to talk about them or negotiate them again.
But you asked me about internationalism. Just not too long ago, we had a representative from the All Japan Seamen's Union that brought over and gave us a million yen.
Wow.
And came and went to the picket lines and letting us know we had their support.
Well, let me ask you about that then, because, you know, that's an interesting. What are the conditions like for the job that you do in Japan? The Japanese companies that own these grain elevators here, what are the conditions like in those countries?
You know, some of them I really don't know for sure. I know they were having some pickets over at protests over at Marubeni in Japan that we have on video that, you know, and I'm not exactly sure what all their, you know, what their conditions are or what their complaints are.
Because, you know, what we see a lot, you know, and we talked about, you know, the Swedwood people, the IKEA people, you know, in the home country, they're good employers,
right,
pay a decent wage because they've got strong laws. I mean, that could have a lot to do
with
it, but it's also part of the culture.
The most expensive, probably one of the most expensive benefits that labor unions negotiate for in the United States is health care.
True.
And that is a federal right in every country we're talking about. I mean, Japanese people pay less for health care and they live longer. And that happens in all of these countries that have universal health care. So what the labor unions are bogged down for, trying to keep health care for their retirees as well as health care for the people in the job place, that's just off the table. All you have to do is, how many miles does it take Canada? And you've got...
Well, soon it's going to be off the table here. At the rate that they're stealing health care from retirees, it might not be a problem here either.
Well, it'd be a problem if they try to steal it from our retirees.
Well, I mean, you look at what's going on with and I don't know if you've been following the Patriot Coal thing. And I'm glad that that's the mentality, because we need more militancy. We need people who are going to take to the streets, much like the miners are going to on July 9th in Fairmont, West Virginia, which we will be there, because they just got screwed in the worst way possible by a bankruptcy judge who said, oh, well, you know, unwarranted optimism. The company set up this shell over here designed to fail with all of the liability and none of the assets. And then when it fails, they act surprised.
Well, one thing about the ILWU that I'm probably personally most proud of is our pensioners, they have the same health benefits that we do.
Fantastic.
I mean, you know, those are the guys that set the table for us. Those are the guys that made everything that we have now. And that, what, you retire, then you're forgot about? I mean, they made the corporations that we work for now all this money for many years. And then what, you can't make them money anymore, so you're not liable for them? We don't believe in that.
I don't believe in it either, but, you know, the sad reality is most working people in this country have been led to believe that there's no other option.
Well, and it's happening now to Social Security. So what George Bush wrote in his memoir was the biggest mistake he made in his administration, which was going after Social Security and listening to Paul Ryan. That's what he said in his memoir. Social Security now is on the chopping block.
Yeah, and he's a Democrat doing it with the change CPI and all of that. It's
only Nixon could go to China.
Well, it is infuriating. You know, you've been doing this how many years now?
This is my 34th year.
you know, in looking back over your 34 years, you know, there was an education process that got you to this point.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is what the grain, what they have done has been so uncharacteristic. When I was a longshoreman before, I was a Marine clerk, and I was actually part of the negotiating committee. And I've never seen anything like this before. I mean, they were tough, yes, but they were fair, and we worked things out, and it worked out good for both. You know, there were contracts where, you know what, they probably got a little bit better than we did, and there was contracts where we got maybe a little bit better than they did. But you know what, both sides, when we were done, we got up, shook hands, and we went back to work. That's not the case now at all.
Don't you think, though, there's a bullseye on labor unions everywhere, and part of that is easily played out when you see what they're doing to teachers? I mean, teachers right now, they've closed how many schools in Philadelphia?
I think 29 last time I checked.
I mean, just to get rid of teachers.
Absolutely. And I, you know, and this is just my opinion, and it's not all about money. A lot of it's about power and control.
I was going to say it's all about power.
Right,
and
you're going to get the money as you get the more power and
Absolutely.
Control. It is.
You know, how do you get someone like Diane Hendricks, the woman who's a billionaire in Wisconsin, to, you know, to say to Scott Walker, oh, when can we have right to work? You know, why is it that she wants this thing, that this right to work? Why does she want a billionaire who could afford everything she could possibly want? Well, not everything. That would give her absolute and total and complete control and allow her to be the robber baron that she wants to
be. You know what I want to see? I want to see where her factory is that made the Walker, the Scott, the Corbett, the LePage.
ABC Building Supply Company.
Yeah, yeah. Acme crappy governor business. I mean.
No, she owns a ABC Building Supply Company.
So that's where she's churning out these governors?
That's where
and talk about a
from.
Union. There is a federation of really bad governors right now that are doing everything they can to dismantle the state, you know, complexes. While it's being done on the federal side.
We're hit on every side. I mean, we are. And I don't feel our government's really standing behind us at all. I mean, in fact, I know they're not.
Well, you got letters from politicians, and what it shows me is, you know, how weak and how ineffective they are. They wrote a couple of letters. What's happened?
Are they voting? Are the letters matching the way they vote? I mean, because it's ink on paper, right, if they then turn around and vote to take away your rights.
I don't think these. We have some pretty good politicians here in the Northwest.
No, we have some good politicians.
And I'm not. Yeah, you know, I.
We're not going to bash
believe,
them.
Right, I won't either. I believe they're behind us. Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon, Senators Murray and Cantwell from Washington. I think they're very good, and the governors are very good. I believe they're behind us, and I don't know how much they can do.
And that's where my problem is. My problem is now you've got these companies who have grown so powerful and they're so big that. And our laws are so weak that they can do virtually nothing but write a letter. And that's my problem. I'm not bashing them at all one way or another. What I'm saying is our laws are so weak that these huge multinational corporations can come in and impose their will when they want. That's my problem.
I agree. And I think we need to change it. How we do that?
Well, we get to the streets. I think we do what you guys are doing. You stand out on the picket line. You talk to neighbors. You talk to friends. You do all of the things that my grandparents' generation did.
I think, you know, and this is, like I said, this is personal now, but to me, things have to get worse.
How much worse can they get?
Well, I'll tell you what. You'll see a lot of people, you ask a lot of people out on the street until we educate them, they think we're on strike.
Yeah.
Even when we were locked out before, they thought we were on strike.
Well, do you think that the problem is that people don't understand the difference between a strike and a lockout?
That's part of it. But part of it also the news they get. You know, those dirty bastards, they make all this money and then they want more. That's all they hear.
Yeah.
Do they hear about how much the corporations make?
Do they hear about what happens to you when you retire? And we went to the miners' last rally, and I look at these guys in their mid-50s who have given their lives to these coal companies who can't stand up straight. Their hands are gnarled. They're breathing through oxygen tubes. They're broken. And well, these companies want to leave them for dead. And I can't imagine it's much different with any manual labor job.
Absolutely not. And it's sad.
You know, though, it's really interesting because we came into town, Carol and I, Rick's beautiful wife, Carol, who is the saint of the trip. She and I came into town in a separate car last night at about 3 a.m. and came here first. And we noticed there was a homeless shelter across the street. Now, there isn't a barrier between this building and the homeless shelter. In fact, when we were outside taking pictures, there were an awful lot of folks over there that were, you know, looking on. And I've worked with poverty for 20 years. I've run a homeless shelter. I have never met a person in a homeless shelter that was a member working in a labor union. Labor unions don't. The people in the labor union do not end up homeless. And this is a funded, when you're talking about the difference between union jobs and non-union jobs, I can walk over there right now and find you people employed. Those aren't a whole pile of people with nothing to do. Those are people who are employed, but I bet a whole pile of them, I'll show you, will be walking out in a fast food uniform or a power retailer, because that's what I had in my homeless shelter. Half of the people that worked there worked for minimum wage, and they were living in a homeless shelter, and the people who pay for the homeless shelters support Walmart and the power and the other power retailers and the fast food joints. They support them by supplying housing to their low-wage workers. And it is infuriating to me that people don't understand the difference between a labor union job and a wrong labor union job is literally a home.
Yeah. I mean, all of us in the ILWU, we are a family. That's why we work basically our master agreement's one agreement. From all the longshoremen on the West Coast, we don't have separate agreements. You might have different working rules in each port, but we all work under the same agreement. We are a family. You know, that stops the employers from saying, well, I'm going to go to Vancouver instead of Portland because they'll work cheaper for me. They know what they're going to pay when they go to a port. We all have the same, like Scott Mason talked about earlier, we all work under the same safety book. We are one. You know, an injury to one, and that's the main thing. We're only as strong as our weakest link.
Boy, if we could get more people to think that way. Now, as I've been saying, if you're not sitting at the table, you're probably on the menu. This is a perfect example.
We don't think that way. We live that way. There's a difference. I mean, we don't, you know, it truly is. I mean, my father was a longshoreman before me, and that's what he taught me. The ILWU has pretty much raised me almost all of my 55 years, and there's not enough I could give back. I mean, there isn't.
George, it was great talking with you. I appreciate your time, your passion. Keep up the fight, and we're with you.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate you being here.
Thanks so much, Pat. George O'Neill.
Very much.
Quick break. Right back with the People's Tour for America. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do through the back door, through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to the NLRB and other agencies.
Really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy, but if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view. What a wonderful world this would be.
Okay, so you're Cager?
Cager, yes.
And Cager, what's your job?
Well, I am Local 4 president. I've been president since middle of December last year. I am a rank-and-file longshoreman. You know, the officers, the way they do their job is they do it in their free time, and if they're forced to take a day off, you know, to do the business of the union, then the union compensates them for that. But primarily for my income, it comes from working on the docks.
So you guys have been locked out. Is there a day off to take?
You know, the members and especially the officers of our local, we're all tight knit. We definitely make sure that guys are able to go and spend time with their families, take a break. You got to have a break. Like my sister-in-law just graduated from nursing school. I was able to go, you know, Eastern Washington and watch her graduate. Other guys have had family in town or trips that they had planned, and we make sure that everybody is able to to, you know, take a break, get their time in.
Now, one of the things we were discussing earlier today is that most people don't really know the difference between a... most people, there's, I'm just, because this is radio, someone is trying to break the picket line right now, and they're all moving over to kind of get in the way of it, which is the point of a picket line, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. It'd just be nice to see a lot more people respect it.
So might this be a person who's just delivering pizza, or is this someone who's going to work and fill your jobs?
Well, I can look over and I can see the video camera that is strapped to their windshield. So I'm fairly certain that it is either a lawyer or somebody with the anti-union security firm that's here to provoke and antagonize and collect data on us. So either that or it's management from United Grain Mitsui.
So they mount something on their dashboard in case there's an altercation so they can use it against you guys?
Yes. Yes, they do.
One would think they might catch something like a truck rolling into a person, though, on that same video. I guess they edit it when that happens.
We do not know what their video cameras capture. We've got our one video camera, and hopefully it's turned on when something bad happens. The port has many, many cameras trained on us. So if there was a problem and we needed video, we could get it. But as far as any video that the company takes, we would never get that.
Now, not unless they want to use it against you. And then you can't be certain. Is it ever admissible against you? I mean, because you don't know if it's been edited.
We have not come into, as far as I know, I have not seen any video from the company or their security firm. We've requested it and have not gotten it. So, I consider myself just a rank and file guy. I don't understand how the laws work as far as subpoenaing and stuff like that. But I'm guessing that when we do get down to videos coming out, that they will be edited to the point that it doesn't make us look very good.
I was started out my career in television, and I'll tell you, we could ask somebody a question and edit it so that they gave us a different answer from the one they actually gave us. Now, we're talking about a lockout, and that's different from a strike. Can you tell me the difference? Because folks who are out there think, well, unfortunately, way too many people in the United States think that, you know, union workers have got it made and they don't want anybody else to have anything and they're trying to put business out of business, which would be stupid. That's like somebody killing their host every time they visited someone, right? but what is the difference? You guys want to work and they won't let you?
Correct. We did what we could to bargain in good faith and reach a fair contract. We were able to do that through our TEMCO agreement, but these grain companies are battling right now, pushed their last, best, and final offer, which, you know, is actually, I believe, the exact same as their first proposal.
Their first, worst, and awful proposal is also their last, best, and final?
That's probably, yeah, the best way to explain it is exactly that. We went to work under the agreement, and apparently they didn't like the way we worked underneath it, so they locked us out.
And yet they'll let other people in who are willing to do your job. Do you know what they're paying those people?
I do not know. I would imagine that it's nowhere near as well as our pay. I'm sure their guys are nowhere near as good as ours are doing that job. We've been doing that. Our union's been doing that job since 1934. And, you know, our guys know that plant inside and out. I doubt that the superintendents have been everywhere we've been inside that facility or even know of them all.
So this is about shipping grain across the ocean to other places and U.S. grain from U.S. farms, that these businesses that are getting this grain have U.S. taxpayer subsidies so that they can do this work, even though they're huge multinational corporations, and they're trying to grind the union to make the U.S. worker who pays the taxes that gives them the subsidies less capable of paying taxes. Is that about right?
I believe that's 100% correct. You know, I've been in this union since 1995 is when I was registered as a union member in the ILWU. I'm third generation. My grandfather was a longshoreman. My father just retired last August as a longshoreman. And here I am, you know, in the middle of all this. And they, you know, they did a really good job educating me as to how the union works and how all we have is strength with everyone. And they, my dad was involved. He was our secretary treasurer for a lot of years. So when I first started down here, I asked what I could do to help. And being the new guy, they put me on political action, which is, I think, where a lot of the new guys end up. So I don't know if it was luck or unluck, I guess, but I ended up doing a lot of the political action for the local. So when they need somebody to come and speak as to, you know, how good it is that they're doing this project, you know, they need a spokesman from the ILWU, it seemed like I was the one that got to go and speak. And it's really kind of interesting to me. The subsidies that the ports get and the companies get are enormous. You know, $178 million is what it costs to dredge the river from the mouth at the Pacific Ocean to United Grain here, which I believe is right around 98 miles. They just did a bunch of lock repair. $50 million to replace the gates because they were failing.
Those are the locks and gates that let the water flow back and forth to keep the level appropriate for the ships.
Yeah, and they allow passage for the wheat barges and other barges upriver as far as, you know, they go as far as Idaho, actually, on the Columbia and Snake River system. The jetty was in really bad shape here a couple of years ago, close to failing. They threw $21.5 million just towards fixing it so it wouldn't break. And now they're looking at a long-term, you know, project of about $470 million, which they haven't started yet, but 18-year job of basically replacing the jetties. And then this West Vancouver freight access here that gives the grain elevators better rail capacity, gives them their unit trains quicker. I mean, these are just millions of dollars. Just kind of looking at it, I came up with about $469 million in tax subsidies that go to the ports and these companies to make their businesses run better. And when they're telling everybody why they need to do these projects, it's always because look at what we do for the community. Look at the wages and the benefits we're returning to the community. This is what the community gets back from having done these projects. So here it is, you know, this grain elevator, they've pretty much got everything they need. They just did their own, you know, I believe $72 million expansion here. They've got the river dredged. They've got the locks taken care of. They've got their rail lines. So they've taken the money that the taxpayers paid into these projects, money that they didn't have to shell out, and now they're fighting the union to break down conditions for us.
And am I understanding you correctly that when they pitch to get these jobs done, the union goes to bat for them?
Yeah, always. And, they, you know, for the most part.
Ouch! Yeah. Ouch, ouch, that hurts. You go to bat for them so they can get this done, and then they turn around and say, we don't want you working, we just locked you out?
Yeah. Oh no, it's the worst. It's betrayal. It really is. I go down to Cape Disappointment as they're talking about when they were talking about the need to do the repairs on the jetty, and I tell them, you know, the jetties are very important so that the river doesn't fill up with sediment, so that I can get ships up to my port so I can go to work. You know, I say, you know, it's very important that these ports, you know, are able to have the freight move freely up and down the river. We need those locks. You know, I say, you know, I even step up for the company. It used to be here at United Grain, they'd do 16 rail cars every 2 hours. And then after you did your 16 rail cars, the empty track was full. So they'd have to rely on the railroad, which is never happens. But anyway, you had to rely on the railroad to come in, remove the empty cars before you could unload the full ones, the next full ones. So you did about 64 rail cars a day if the railroad was on top of their schedule. There was times when we'd sit around waiting for the railroad to come and pull their empties, you know, and basically the elevator's paying a crew to not unload rail cars. And so when they're talking about the West Vancouver freight access and how important it is, that would always be the example I would use. You know, it used to be we wouldn't have the capacity to unload more than 16 rail cars at a time, and without having to wait for the railroad to come and take out the empty cars. And that would cost our employers money. And now with the new, when they had the new rail lines put in, you know, you're talking about doing 120 rail cars, unloading those rail cars in 7 hours.
Wow.
So you've more than doubled your production. You're not reliant on the railroad to come and take and service your company. So, you know, it's just stuff like that. And we all do it. We go home and say, hey, you know what? These guys are good employers. They pay us well. We've got good benefits. You know, it's good that we're doing this stuff for them, that they're receiving these tax subsidies, you know, because they are. They're putting people to work. Well,
no more.
Yeah, no more. They've got everything they need. So, you know what? See you later. See you later, longshoremen. We're going to bring in scabs to do your work for pennies. And we're going to spend millions of dollars to get rid of you. You know, it's tripping over dollars to hopefully make dimes. You know, it's sickening.
Well, Cager Claybaugh?
Claybaugh.
Claybaugh, Local 4 president, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So if we sign away our rights to be wildcat striking, you know they're gonna push us around. Mr. Heff and Digger, Mr. Hardy can haul it, 'cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground. Mr. Taft and Deegan, Mr. Hartley can haul it, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's gonna take a lot along at an 80 short day for his miner to cool on down. Mr. Taft can dig it, Mr. Hartley can haul it, 'cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
Right, I'm here with Tom Owens, business agent for Local 8, and Troy Mosler? Mosler?
Mosteller.
Like it's spelled. Yeah. Oh, sorry about that. Labor Relations Committee member. Now, is this another lockout we're at?
This is a lockout here. We've been locked out by Columbia Grain. Where'd you like this in there?
Yeah, and so Columbia Grain's behind us, and I just tried to chat with some of those guys in the tents. They weren't chatty. So those guys are like the Pinkerton cops, right? They're here in case you guys get out of line?
If you get on their website and read what they do, they offer special strike operations for labor disputes, whatnot. Security, they'll also provide with labor, scab labor. They bill themselves as being able to bring in any kind of trade that you may or may not need for your job sites, and they can have as many workers as you need within 96 hours. More than willing to come in and do a union man's job.
Wow, and now, what is the name of that organization? I'm calling them the Pinkertons, but that's me being funny. So what's their real name?
It's a Gettier Security Forces, and I think it's owned by J.R. Gettier, but I'm not, most of the information I have on them I gleaned from the websites.
Okay, I'll go do that myself. Actually, it was Gettier guys, I think, up in Washington, too. I tried to talk to them, yep. Not chatty. They did, however, videotape me, so I'm sure their wives will enjoy that.
This is on tape as well, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, but this guy, like, picked a videotape up. A video camera up in the car and started videotaping me. So I was like, well, I can audio tape you. You raised me one. Okay, so they locked you out because why? I mean, you want to go to work and they won't let you go to work because?
From the start, they've been pretty aggressive about their contract negotiations to us. It just seemed like from the start they were never really trying to be fair or bargain in good faith. They implemented a contract that they felt was fair, that we all voted down unanimously, I believe around 90-something percent, and the union voted no on it. For the most part, there's no arbitration processes or a way for a worker to get any kind of representation. So they implemented most of that contract, not all of that contract on us. We worked for it under it for several months, and it seems to us that as it got slower here and the facility worked less and less, they were able to lock the workers out and try to strong-arm us some more.
Now, aside from the security workers, is anybody in there working?
They have some of the old managers and management companies, the management staff. They're working the facilities. I know a few of the guys that used to be the ship superintendents. I believe they're working on the vessels and doing longshore jobs.
Okay, and then when I was over at the other place, they had new concrete poured and some other stuff done, and they brought in guest workers from Guatemala. Do you know if they're doing any of that here?
We're not sure if they have brought any other workers in. We do know that some of the unions that were doing some new construction here, they have actually pulled their equipment out. So we are getting some support from some of the other construction trades.
Oh, that's great. So you've got unions backing unions.
Yeah, I think we've had a few good showings of solidarity. I know the PG linemen really stepped up here. The power went out of the facilities. They had to go in and they crossed the lines only to repair it at other facilities that are in the area, but then they backed out and went back through our lines and said, hey, we're not going to work that. We're not going to fix it. And so they had to wait a day and bring management in. So it was nice to see that because you don't see that very often anymore. You know?
And these jobs now, these guys, have they also gotten federal and state subsidies to be doing business? And those are the taxes you guys paid, right?
Yeah, to my knowledge, they've collected over a couple $100 million between them as a group. I believe it's a grain cartel, so how much each individual company gets, I'm not exactly sure. But, yeah, they get tax subsidies, they profit in billions, and then they don't want to give back to the workers.
Now, when the union-busting workers come through here, what happens? You guys block them? Have you had any kind of altercation?
There's been a couple instances. I don't know about with the security guards, but they bring in dust trucks which come from maybe all over the states. And on a couple occasions, they've just failed to even respect our First Amendment rights to be out here and voicing our opinions and expressing our frustration with the lockout. And they've actually ran over our guys and hit them pretty hard with their trucks. So.
Oh, my gosh. Did any of those guys get checked out?
One guy went to the hospital, I know for sure, and I think the police are investigating off of some of the videos that were around here and taking up the incident, but I'm not really able to speak on it because I'm not fully aware of everything that's ongoing with it.
Now, they're videotaping the living daylights out of you, so who knows what's kept. I mean, you can take a whole lot, trust me, I'm in the business, you can take a whole pile of tape and delete it.
Yeah.
So have you guys got video also?
Yeah, we've been keeping video. We try to get as much as we can of different different vehicles coming in and out, and so we're trying to keep an eye on what's coming in, what's coming out. But we don't have the capabilities of their video systems.
So are you guys here at night too?
Yeah, we spend 24 hours a day at the lines.
So that doesn't sound wicked lazy to me. Sounds like you guys, if they just unlock that door and pay you a decent wage, you'd be in there working.
We're ready to go back. I think we took a lot of concessions and we're able to deal with that. We've talked about that at the table with them. I think the union really would like to have some kind of system set in place that protects itself and its workers, an arbitration position where maybe if there's problems for the worker or there's issues that need to be raised, you can have some kind of representation on the job other than just what the company thinks. We're ready to go to work. We want to work for these guys, and we've worked for them for a long time.
What's the sentiment in the community here? I mean, Joe and Jane Shopper at Walmart, are they understanding what you're doing?
I think some people are. A lot of it doesn't get put out to the public, though. The media doesn't portray this to the public of being an issue of the working class, you know. But we spend all of our money we make in the industry here in our local area, and none of this money that they're making gets spent in our area at all.
Yeah, these are multinational corporations. Now, the average guy who doesn't understand why his $7.50 can't make ends meet. You know, he's making $7.50 an hour. If you're even $8.25. Let's say they got a generous manager over at Walmart. They're making $8.75. How come they don't see you guys as their natural allies instead of somebody who's got something they haven't got?
I think it's just the world. They, instead of trying to rise up and try to better ourselves, I think some people try to hold it against you for but we pay the price. I mean, we've worked really hard, and our grandpas and fathers have fought for these jobs and fought for our rights that we've had over 80 years. So, we've learned how to deal and how to, fight for our rights as workers.
Now, I heard the Oregonian, has gotten maybe a couple of the thes and the a's in the right place, and other than that, the story's been kind of messed up. That's got to be working against you, too.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't help when you're not getting good support from the press. And then that's what the communities read. I've had family members call and say, hey, what's going on with this? I read this, and it's completely not, it's completely false. So it is frustrating that your actual position's not represented properly, and nobody ever likes to, be misunderstood, I guess. You know what I mean? So it's extremely frustrating for us. You know.
Yeah, I obviously tried to talk to the guys here. They won't talk to me. That's not my fault. But if they wanted to, they would be welcome to. And I will call and try and talk to management here, give them a chance to talk. But it seems like as long as they can, and that is a journalist's job, by the way, as long as they can control the media, they don't have to talk to somebody who's actually going to get both sides of the story out, you know. And that's frustrating. I'm from the East Coast. I knew nothing about what's going on here. Nothing. One last question. I heard that there was a grain train or something that was stopped. Do you guys know about that? Was that, no?
That would be another, I believe that would have belonged to another battle up in Longview. That's not anything going on here.
Okay, so that has nothing to do with us?
It's all to my knowledge, yeah.
Okay.
Unless there's something I'm unaware of. There's something I'm unaware of I don't know, but I think that might be a story from another labor dispute that was taking place last year.
Okay, great. And that was a happy ending?
We did end up getting our self in there, so it's something to work on with our contract. But, you know, it was a concessionary deal as well.
I always say I have one last question, and I always mean two. There also is a something that happens to every – I used to run homeless shelters, and the thing that happened to every person that worked in that homeless shelter, that lived in the homeless shelter that worked, was they worked for people who didn't respect the fact that they couldn't even get a second job because their occupation was unreliable. They'd have 3 hours one day and 10 hours the next, and they never knew what their schedule was going to be, and this literally made them victims of their workplace because they couldn't do anything to get another job, you know, and augment their income. That is actually the retrograde, one of the changes they were trying to make in your union contract was, right? They wanted to make your hours unreliable.
That's correct. Longshoremen for years have fought for an 8-hour workday, family first, obviously. And the implemented contract, they went from an 8-hour day with the ability to go to 10 hours. They went to just a straight 12-hour day. They wouldn't even give you the courtesy of letting you know what the start or stop times of these shifts may be. So you might at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon find out you're working until 7 o'clock at night. And that depends if you'd start at 7 in that morning. I think workers just like to have some kind of reliability, something they can count on, something that they can tell their families that they'll be at the kids' games or not. We worked under that contract, and we weren't happy with it, but we kept doing what was required of us, and it's extremely frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, anything, even a doctor's appointment you might have to miss if they change a shift on you.
Yeah, on a 12-hour workday, you're not making too many doctor's appointments.
Now, I didn't say this prior to this, even though we've done all these interviews. You guys are longshoremen. You know, if I was going to mess with someone, I might mess with the cupcake makers union. You know what I mean? You're longshoremen. You work hard every day. You know, what part of that do people not get?
I'm frustrated by it. You know, I respect your respect, I guess you'd say, but these corporations are so big and they have so much money that they can hire firms that these guys probably need jobs too, and they'll do anything to get that job.
You know, that's one of the questions I want to ask the guys that were leaving the other gate that we were at. I wanted to say, how many kids do you have? How desperate are you? You know that if you got out of that car and joined this line, your life would improve. How desperate are you that you don't want your life to improve? That's what I wanted to ask them, you know?
Yeah, it's sad to me. It almost seems like scab's not a bad word today in America's workforce. I don't know. I'm a fourth-generation longshoreman. I take a lot of pride in it. I'd ask my grandfather, how do you be union? He said, kid, if you want to be union, you never cross another man's picket line. And I think that's kind of going by the wayside. I don't know if the American workers know that you even have those rights to bond together and stand together and fight. They stripped unions of their ability to represent their workers, and this is just another constant attack on the union workforce in America.
No, you know, when I saw the new Army slogan, an army of one, I knew we were done. You know, every other Army slogan you ever saw since the beginning, you know, since George Washington was, never leave your buddy, protect your buddy. And when it went to an Army of One, every man for himself, you know, that's what they're trying to instill in the United States.
Yeah, it seems like it. We're getting attacked every day with different scenarios on all of our ports, and you know, we're just trying to battle for the working man.
Thank you, Tom Owens, business agent for Local 8 and Labor Relations Committee member Troy Must tell her. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Action of crime, speed of crime. Hungry jungle hunters with one on bandit eyes. Mother Nature's army retreats to hide and fly. So what's it all about?
We're smart policy. And sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
My cup is empty. and I haven't got a penny. But I buy no more whiskey, I have to go home.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So as we wrap up our coverage of our time in Portland and Portland, Oregon, Vancouver, Washington, I'm left with, you know, a sense of, one, hope, but two, immense sadness and anger, because it shouldn't be this way. Our laws are so pathetically weak. Our laws are so badly broken, in need of reform. It just leaves me, well, just, I guess angry is the best word for it.
Yeah, I don't think there's a way to see a whole pile of hardworking, decent people that have been told, we don't care about your obligations, we don't care about your families, we don't care about anything but our bottom line, so you don't come back to work. And we knocked on the glass of the people who were crossing the picket line. We tried to give them a chance. I wasn't going to give them a hard time. I just wanted to say, how many kids do you have? What's making it worth your while? You know, if you get out of that car and join these guys right here, you'd all have a better paycheck. You know, it's not that these guys want to gouge the system. It's that they want you to get a good paycheck, too. Why can't everybody in America get decent wage for their talents and their abilities and their dedication? You know, I put this stuff up on Facebook, and people are saying, longshoremen don't work hard enough.
What?
I'll tell you what. You say that to one of these guys' faces. I would like to see that. I'd like to see, I'm sure they won't touch you, but I bet you flinch anyway.
Exactly.
You know? That was just...
And you know, the thing is, you know, and you did the interviews of the guys there, because, you know, when I get on picket line today, I get lost in people's stories, and I get lost in conversations, because I've been on those picket lines myself. My family has had to fight through those. So I've been there, and I know how they feel to a certain degree. And, you know, these are guys who, the vast majority of them served their country. Most of them were in the military. The vast majority of them have never seen a day of not working.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that gets me. These are the people who bust their behinds day in, day out, year after year after year, only to be treated and used and abused in this fashion. And it should be angering to all of us.
It's true, too. I mean, these guys, if they aren't there to unload that ship, you don't get whatever you want or to load that ship. But can you imagine the board of directors for these huge companies that are getting these huge tax subsidies? Can you imagine them rolling up their sleeves and unloading one of those ships?
No.
Can you imagine them getting their manicures chipped while they unload these ships?
And the politicians, look, I don't blame the CEOs. We're letting them do what they can do. I blame the politicians. I blame us for putting those people into place who've passed the laws or have allowed the laws to be eroded. I blame us for voting for presidents who put in these Supreme Court justices who have screwed us every step of the way. I blame us more than anything.
I agree. I think it's about time the American people stand up, and that's why we've got on our website a place where you can go and send a message directly to your congressperson. You can go and you can say, do something about this lockout, and make sure you do the right thing about this lockout. You go and you stick up for the taxpayer. You stick up for the taxpayer in Vancouver, Washington, and in Portland, Oregon, and you tell those companies that they milked us dry, and now the least they can do is open those doors and let those men go back to work. Hundreds of ships went through there last year, and now six have gone through there this year? That's not good for the economy in any way, shape, or form.
I'm with you. And the sad reality is, you know, and going back to the, we've given these politicians so much power. When they want to do the right thing, the sad reality is there are so few of them now that are willing to stand up and do the right thing. And we've given so much power to these big corporations, these huge multinational conglomerates, that, well, when a few politicians who want to do the right thing want to, they're ignored.
Yeah.
They're set aside.
God love Bernie Sanders. We just got to clone him. But short of cloning Bernie Sanders, go to the website, go to the PeoplesTourForAmerica.com, or go to TheRickSmithShow.com, and make sure you send a message to your congressperson. We have a little person who's trying to have a conversation with us.
Thanks, Allie. You got to go back into the back of the RV for just a few more minutes.
That's what happens when you do a show live
on the road.
On the road with a bunch of little kids and Brett, the unsung hero, Brett the producer, and the whole bunch of us. And you know what? It's not easy to take a bunch of little kids on a trip all across the country to talk about labor history, but I'm proud of you, Rick Smith.
We're
doing
it. We are doing it.
Because it's important. People need to know what's happening. And nobody's out there telling them.
And if you want to find out more, thepeoplestourforamerica.com. That's where you go to find out where we've been, where we're going. Hope you've enjoyed our coverage. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show on the road, the people's tour for America. Pat, it has been... I can't tell you how many days now. What is this? 18, 20, 50?
It depends on...
100?
Yeah. About 100. Yeah, it's a little over 3 months. Or 2.5 weeks.
2.5 weeks.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, as much fun as it's been, sometimes with the young ones, a little trying.
Hey, you know what? I think they think we're trying, too, and they might be right. I mean... Strap me in a car seat and take me on a 12-mile or 12-hour ride. I might be a little bit cranky. I think, you know, it is a little challenging sometimes, but they have done a wonderful job. They're great kids.
Their mother does an outstanding job. And I'm quite
she
fortunate.
Does with all four of you.
All four children. Yes. Make sure we're all bathed and fed and tucked in at night. Yep.
She is. She's wonderful.
But we're on the road... Made it to Portland, Oregon. I mean, I got to be honest. I think that's so far one of my favorite stops.
Really?
Yeah, I liked Portland. I think it was because I really identified with the guys who were really just getting screwed.
Okay, so it's all right that Carol and I want to make a new Teamsters calendar. Think it's a great fundraiser for the effort. Those fellas. Oh my, fuck. Longshoremen.
The ILWU.
Oh, yeah, whatever. Fellas. The fellas. They were hot and muscular and, you know, I mean, support a Teamster. No, ILWU. Yeah, I'm sorry. I keep calling them Teamsters. They're the longshoremen. They're the Stevers. The Stevies.
Stevedores.
Oh, yeah. They were hot. Yeah.
Not nearly as hot as it was in Arizona and New Mexico, but you know, as I look at the
They were
as I look
smoking
at the,
hot.
Well, it's,
yeah.
That is one person's opinion, and,
yeah.
And I'm glad it's yours. But you know, I look at the situation, and you know, as you're going to find out throughout the program, as we have conversations with a number of the leadership and some of the members, we actually went out to two of the lockout lines where the workers are picketing. You know. One of the things that I want to clarify right from the front, because, you know, we hear a lot of people, when you see guys out on a picket line, oh, they're on strike because they're greedy or some other reason that's been thrown at these guys, they want to go to work. They want to go to work right now.
Oh, yeah, they want to go to work so much that they're staffing that picket line 12 hours a day. I mean, they'd much rather be working. Much rather be working. It's ridiculous that they've been locked out of their jobs.
And this is an example of, you know, really international, global corporate greed. These are two foreign corporations who have refused a bargain, something that has been, you know, pretty much the norm for the area for, I think it was like 80 years, that these contracts have, you know, they've had their problems in the past. But this one, and as you'll find out as we move on through the discussions, this one a little bit different. This one's the companies, these foreign companies saying, you know what? Time's right. The disaster has taken hold. Now it's time for disaster capitalism. It's time for us to go and take back all of those hard-fought gains, all of those conditions that people fought for in the past and, well, do away with it all in one felt swoop.
You know, that whole we don't negotiate with terrorists thing, I'm starting to think that's the attack we've got to take with these multinational corporations. You know, they are the terrorists of this world. I wrote an op-ed piece about the mountaintop removal. You talk about the Taliban. They blew up a couple of Buddhist statues and the whole of the UN went crazy. The mining companies in West Virginia are blowing mountains to kingdom come. And now these multinational corporations taking $500 million, $450 million in state and federal subsidies in Washington and in Oregon. And they're locking out the workers. They're locking out the taxpayers that paid the taxes for the subsidies they got.
It's the American way, Pat.
That's a slap across the face on top of everything else they're doing to them.
But, you know, as we talk to these folks, I just, you know, you look at these guys and you have big, strong, hulking,
yeah,
in the prime of their lives. And my daughter, as we were leaving, she goes, they're really sad. My daughter said, you know, the one guy, when he was talking to you, it looked like he was about ready to cry. And I go, well, you know what? He's got a family to feed.
Yeah. He's got obligations that he has the honorable nature to try and meet. In the meantime, these multinational corporations that are taking U.S. taxpayer dollars, they're not honorable. They're not honoring the fact that these people have worked for them. And you'll hear later on when we're talking to these guys, they went and testified in the state houses in Washington and Oregon asking for these multinational companies to get the subsidies.
Yep.
Talk about feeling like a fool. They went and said, this is our jobs. Make sure you give these guys the subsidies. And then they get locked out?
It's the American way, Pat.
That's disgusting.
It's how we do things in America.
Ugh.
It's kind of like I've been talking about. It's Stockholm Syndrome. You know, we identify with our captors, but these are the people who have said no.
These guys are not identifying. No, they are standing their ground.
Which is why they were kicked to the curb.
Right.
Which is why we need to support them.
How come standing your ground is okay in Florida, where you get to shoot a little black kid, but standing your ground isn't so good at a picket line?
Because I got my gun.
Sad stuff.
Anyway, tonight we're going to be talking to the folks with the ILWU, highlighting their history, highlighting their struggles, and we're going to talk about, you know, how can we help them? We're going to take a quick break from the road, the People's Tour for America on the road. If you missed any portion of our coverage, TheRickSmithShow.com or People's Tour for America. Right back from the road. Stick around.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith. The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. The People's Tour for America has rolled into Vancouver, Washington. We're here at the ILWU headquarters here in Vancouver, Washington, talking about, you know, the Labor History Tour, going across the country, talking to people. I've got Jim Norton here sitting with me. He's a pensioner, local 23 of the ILWU. Jim, thanks for taking time for us.
Excuse me?
Thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
You know, as we're moving across the country and as we're talking to people about the history of their unions, I thought it was important that the ILWU's history be told as well, because it's a rich history of activism and a rich history of people being involved. And, you know, I just wanted a little bit get your history on this. You know, you're a pensioner. Congratulations. You made it.
Thank you.
How'd you get started?
I was working as a young man. I was working on a log boom in Tacoma. And they went out of business, and a friend of mine asked me to just come down to Longshore Hall and see if you like it. And I knew a lot of fellows that were longshoremen, and that was in 1963. And at that time, I started working as a casual longshoreman, and I stayed till I retired. I worked myself up through the ranks. I held many offices in the local, and I participated in a lot of union activities and all the time I was in the local.
Yeah, and what were the conditions like when you started?
When I started longshoring, let me say something first. Longshoring, they call us stevedores or longshoremen. A lot of people don't know where the term longshoreman came from.
Okay.
That term came in the 1800s. A ship would come into port, and they were usually schooners, very small ships, and they could dock at any kind of dock, a warehouse, or even come ashore, and they'd lay a gangplank down. But before they got there, the first mate or the captain would holler, "Work along the shore, along the shore," and they wanted people to come and help them unload the cargo. So from that derived the term longshoreman, and that's how we got, other than stevedore, that's how we got longshoreman.
Yeah, I always wondered that. Yeah,
yes. They'd holler, "Along the shore," and then guys would come and unload the vessel for them.
Interesting.
Or, you know, load it.
Yeah.
Both ways.
Either way.
Yeah, when I started longshoring, a lot of the work was hand work, handling 100-pound sacks, 150-pound sacks. Everything was done mostly by hand. Mechanization hadn't taken over the waterfront yet.
What year was this?
This was 1963, and we didn't sign the mechanization agreement till 1966. That's when we gave up some of our work rules, concessions to mechanize, but the employer had to guarantee us work. For mechanization, they guaranteed us jobs.
And that wouldn't happen today.
Probably not today, no.
So let me ask you, in looking at the conditions that you worked under in the 60s, you know, I'm sure they were much better than they were in the 30s.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And what were the conditions like in the 1930s?
In the 1930s, I'll take San Francisco. That was the hub of the stevedore longshore activity on the West Coast. That's where probably when we had problems that usually originated in San Francisco because it was the largest port. But in those days, you would go on a ship, and you would start the ship, and you could work till the ship finished. In other words, you could work 10 hours, 12 hours, 14 hours. I actually talked to some of the old-timers when I had gone to caucuses. That's a longshore division where we set demands for the contract.
Right.
And those fellas had worked 18 hours straight before they got a break. And when I started longshoring in 1963, we still had the 10-hour day and the 8-hour day, but it dropped from that time. It dropped from the 18 hours to 8 hours.
That was because, you know, people fought for that, right?
That was because of the 34 strike. In 1934, we had a coastwise strike on the West Coast, and the main strike issues were a joint dispatch hall where we could dispatch men from that hall to the job, and the other one was called the shape-up. What the shape-up was you didn't go to the hall to get your job. You went down to the dockside alongside the ship, and a foreman would stand there, and he would pick the individuals out to go to work.
That he wanted.
Some of them would put a pencil behind their ear or a cigarette, and then he'd pick them out. But they usually gave him a fifth of whiskey, or they bought him lunch. There was some gratuity involved,
of course,
for them to get a job. So once we got the dispatch hall, then all that stopped. Then we had a joint dispatch hall where you went to work by earnings. In other words, if I went to work one day and you didn't have a job, the next day you'd go to work. So that's how then conditions kept getting better and better as time went by.
And that's important because, you know, you think back and you go, why do people go on strike? Why do people organize? And I always say it always comes down to conditions first, hours and then wages. And, you know, wages, hours, conditions, that's the reason people organize. And, you know, the more people we talk to on this tour, we find that, you know, the conditions, you know, of the past were horrible, got better, and now we're heading back towards horrible.
Yes. In 1934, they're up and down the West Coast. The conditions were horrific. I mean, there wasn't any one port where people weren't. We had people that were maimed, broken arms, broken fingers. I mean, it was terrible work. Work 10 to 18 hours on a shift. And now it's better. But the employer now has got a an appetite again to go back to those same, some of those same conditions.
The good old days.
The good old days for them, not for us.
Not for us.
You know, and so we're going to we have to, this is the problem we have. We're going to have to fight this.
And you, you go back and you look at the actions that went on, and it didn't come without a huge cost. And, you know, as we're going across the country and we're learning about the labor history, people literally died for the eight-hour day, literally died for safe working conditions, for decent wages, decent hours. We don't learn that in our schools anymore.
In 1934, we have a holiday in our union. It's called Bloody Thursday, July 5th. That's the day that two longshoremen were shot in the back in San Francisco. One fellow's name was Nick Bordes, and the other was Howard Sperry. And they left them laying on the sidewalk, and they were both shot in the back. And at that time, we were in tough in a strike, and we didn't know what we were going to do. But that, as horrific as it was, that united the people in San Francisco. They had a funeral for those fellows, and they marched down Market Street in San Francisco. 40,000 people marched in that parade. And as they went along the street, women and children would step into this march and march with the union. And from that, when they shot those two guys, the public turned against them, and it broke the employer's back. And then we had a general strike. Our leader at that time was Harry Bridges. He was the head of the ILWU, and he was well respected by labor on the West Coast. And he went to all the other unions, and they had a general strike. And that broke the employer's back. That's when we got the joint dispatch hall, and the shape-up was done with. We went by earnings in the hall.
Yeah, but it was off the back of the blood of two.
That was off. That was not. Those weren't the only two guys that got killed. But that set the stage in San Francisco. Yes, now, there was violence up and down the coast. Terrible violence.
Now, in West Texas, a couple of months ago, a fertilizer plant exploded. And we were there last week or so. I don't remember the day anymore.
Yeah,
but there is a tribute to the seven fallen firefighters. There is nothing there. Nobody is saying how do people die in the workplace. I mean, where if those two deaths and the ones that came before them could work to a critical mass so that people act, where's the action today?
Well, I'm not too sure I understand your question.
It's just that, you know, I'm waiting for this critical mass. If people can die in the workplace in 2013, I mean, and blow up a school and a senior home, and this fertilizer plant had no safety, no inspection since the 1980s, where's the outrage that leads to the kind of change?
Well, I think the problem is this country is being run by corporate America. And what you're talking about, say that would have happened in the 50s or the 40s, there would have been recognition by labor that they would have done something. But labor is in such a position now in this country that the corporate America controls labor that we really don't have the say that we should. We're going to have to fight. We're going to, you know.
But doesn't that come down to each one of us, to what we teach our children and so on?
It depends on education. Education is a big factor and what we do in the future, unions.
Which is why we're doing this tour, which is why I think it's so important that we talk about the strike in 34 and we talk about the history and how you made the work that you did for all of your years safe, how you made that work a livable wage, how you made that a middle-class existence. Because today what we're seeing is we're seeing the 1880s, 1890s all over again.
Yes, and I think one of the biggest problems that unions have in this country today is they're not unified. We have too many international unions that don't share in the problems we have. We're separated. We're divided. You know, unions, I hate to say this, but one union will go through another union's picket line. That's the worst thing we can do as union people. That's what's happening. Labor is fragmented in this country. We've got to unify labor.
Well, let me ask you, Jim, because, you know, I've heard that before, and I go back and I think about my grandparents, who, you know, they lived through the Depression. They fought World War II. They came back with a mentality that, you know, we're all in this together. You know, do you think today you could get people to get the people today to get behind them?
Yes.
You do?
I really do. I have a lot of faith in a worker. And we have some bright, bright people in the union movement today. You know, they're well-educated, a lot more than we were in the past. And I think under the right conditions, labor can make a comeback. It's going to be hard, but I think it can be done.
Is it going to be, hopefully, not a situation where two more workers get killed or more? Because, you know, as we've been going across the country, we've been seeing these stories. You know, in Memphis, it took the two sanitation workers dying in the back of a garbage truck to spark community outrage. It took, you know, in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, it took, you know, 19 workers being shot in the back before you sparked the outrage. Is it going to be something like that?
No, I hope to God it's not going to be. I think with the membership we have in the unions today, they're well educated, they're smart. We have to take a different approach. I mean, the days of storming the precipice are gone. I mean, knocking down the buildings and, you know, and we don't want to get anyone hurt, and we don't want to hurt anyone. I think we have intelligence enough in some of our unions to move forward, and that's what we got to do. The biggest thing is we've got to unify labor in this country.
I'm right there with you. I'm absolutely not just unionized labor, all labor,
I'm talking about all labor.
I mean, people have got to realize that we're all in this together, because if we're not, well, we're going to all get picked off one by one. So let me ask you the last line of questioning I've got for you, Jim. You know, in looking at back over your years, you're going down the road. You know, your work years are behind you, and hopefully you're having a wonderful retirement. You know, what about the guy coming behind you? What advice do you give them? What advice do you give their children?
What I see in the young union member today, when I go to the union hall, I go down there every once in a while. There's no more camaraderie. They aren't close like they used to be. We were very close. I mean, and the young people today don't understand how they got everything that they have.
And how do we get them to realize that?
We've got to educate them. Educate, educate, educate. And that's what we have to do, and we aren't doing that. We're trying, but we aren't doing it enough. We have people now that they come off the street and they have a completely different feeling for the union than we did when we were young and went in the union. They're just a different type of young individual, and we've got to bring those people around. You know, we've got to instill a union in them, unionism in
community.
Them. Unity, too, and what it is to work together, you know, and have the strength of the union behind you.
Do you reach out to the media locally? I mean, Rick's show is so unique because he does this 3 hours a night, every single night of the day, of the week, every week, every work night. Do you reach out to the local media, and do you get any coverage?
My feeling is we don't reach out to the local media enough. But to reach out to the local media, you have to be careful because you have to make sure that they're receptive to labor. And a lot of the media today aren't receptive to labor. And our local paper in Tacoma, we have to be careful because sometimes they print things that they construe things, they take them out of context. And that's one of the problems we have.
No, that's the problem with corporate.
But we have to have the public behind us. We can't go without the public.
Yep.
We've got to have public support.
There's got to be a way to do it, though. They did it when William Randolph Hearst ran the papers, and he was the worst SOB that ever lived, practically, when it comes to media. So there's got to be a way, because really, this story, Rick Smith.
No, we're doing it.
And everybody that needs this story needs to hear this show.
Yep.
But I think, like the program you have, there has to be more of this. I think the union has to get involved in some of this stuff. I mean, more than they do. We've got to get to the public. The public now, you know, I mean, turn on the TV. You know, you listen to these big corporations, what they're doing all over the world. I mean, everything's international now. And we've got to take our place in this. You know, we've got to get in the fight.
I'm right there with you.
You know, so it's not going to be easy.
Never
it's just
is.
Like these grain negotiations. I mean, they're coming after us. You know, I've been around a little while, and I haven't seen it like this before. But, you know, we've had fights before, and we've come out of them pretty well. So I have a lot of faith in these young guys we have today. They're all smart, they're well-educated, and they'll take care of business.
I hope so. Jim Norton, I appreciate the time. It was really great talking with you. Thanks for sharing your experience. We're going to take a quick break from Vancouver, Washington, the People's Tour for America. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on, get up, stand up.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, Pat, I listened to Jim there, and you know, you think back to the conditions of the 20s and the 30s, and I think, you know, as we've been saying on this tour, I think we've really forgotten how bad things used to be.
I think we definitely have, you know, but I've spent an awful lot of my time traveling this country with the country's underclass, and things are that bad again. They're that bad for millions and millions of people. It's just that we've all been beaten down and told not to complain, and you know, it's bad for me, but it could be worse. And, you know, we see the jar on the counter for a kid who needs a surgery, or you see the jar on the counter for the old man who can't afford a wheelchair, and people dig in their spare change and they throw it in the cup. Like that's the way a country's supposed to be run.
What?
You know?
We're not supposed to run our senior programs off a lottery and education off of, you know, off a lottery.
Well, you know what? I don't even mind that as much as I mind the fact that we're begging for it. We're begging for it, and it's supposed to be run off charity? No, it's not supposed to be run off charity. It's supposed to be run by an efficient government, well-funded by taxing the people who have made it the best. The people who have, because of this country, because of the blessings of liberty and the protections of their strong military and the past history of however bad imperialism has brought them to this incredible wealth, they're supposed to pay back. How come the rest of us are supposed to pay back, but the extremely wealthy aren't? That's how we're supposed to pay for that stuff. But yeah. Even if it's done, even if it's taxation for people who can't do math, like in the case of a lottery, at least the government is sponsoring it.
You know, and you look at the statistics and the wealth concentration in the hands of the so few, and I think you pointed out, what was it, the top 10 of Fortune 500s, the top 10 CEOs, people there in the
top 10 wealthiest people in the country make the same money as all the people who work in fast food. And the entire nation, millions, I think it was about 3.5 million people have the same annual income as the top 10. Everybody in fast food.
I mean, it goes back to the days, you know, to where Jim Norton was talking about, you know, where you had the very, very robber barons, and then the rest of us, you know, toiling in horrible conditions. And you know, I've spoken to some of the fast food workers over the last several months. You know, this is not a great job.
And you know what? They're still nice to you for 7 1/4 an hour. When I get a Big Mac, I ought to get my face slapped at the same time.
I'm sure someone just slapped you for the GP.
Just for the fun of it. Yeah, really.
Just for general principle.
as an act of charity. No, but I mean, seriously, people are kind, you know, when you walk into a place, into a power retailer to get something, and the guy who helps put your kid's bicycle together, you look at him, he smiles at you, and you know every one of his teeth hurts. You know, this is a kingdom's judged by its people. And our kingdom is rotten, because our kings are rotten. And they are kings. They're oligarchs. I was in a prison, kids' prison in Coconino County, Arizona, a couple of months ago, interviewing the children that were there. And they had a government teacher who was trying to teach them the difference in governments, theocracies and democracies and socialism and communism. And there was oligarchy. And I said, son of a gun, you're teaching about oligarchy. And you know, oligarchy is when the wealthy and the powerful make all the rules just because they're wealthy. When the people with the money get to be the bosses. And it doesn't matter if they're fit.
I mean, at least in a monarchy, somebody with some faith believes that God gave someone some power. This is just having power because you have money. And if you can steal that money from somebody else, then you get the power that goes with it.
The workers.
Right, you steal it from the workers.
And the thing is, you know, as we go through today's program and we talk to these guys from the ILWU, these are companies that are very profitable. They're doing just fine, thank you very much, but they want more. And that's my problem. It's that more. And I go back to the CEO of Caterpillar who said, you know, you can never make enough profit. And if that's the view, you can never make enough profit, what does that mean for the working people? What does that mean for folks like you and me, Pat?
There's never enough blood I can wring out of your blood, sweat, and tears. And it's offensive because they're not just screwing the longshoremen. They're screwing the farmers that are growing the grain that now can't leave the country because these people have decided to lock out the workers that would load the boats. So the farmers who need to sell their grain are, and maybe it's all Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland, but it, and for those guys, I don't really care. But it's not. It's a farmer.